This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So the Chechen Wars are part of this Muslim Brotherhood CIA unholy alliance. Most terror organizations today, virtually everyone in Iraq and Syria, most every terrorist so-called jihad organization active is a direct descendant of this CIA Muslim Brotherhood operation that developed a military capability with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the 80s.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, F. William Engdahl. Today's show, The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the power of oil, food, and money control. His book, Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we discuss the history of the Muslim Brotherhood and its involvement with the CIA. William Engdahl, welcome again.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be with you again, Bonnie.
In your book, The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, An Historical Overview of the Muslim Brotherhood, or Radical Political Islam, you begin with a discussion of the Christian Crusades going back over 1,000 years and liken former President George W. Bush's War on Terrorism, a modern-day crusade, to the Christian Crusades of the 11th century. What are the similarities? Do they share common goals?
The similarities between the Christian Crusades that began in the 11th century, the late 11th century, and lasted, by the way, for 200 years, and the War on Terror is that the Christian Crusades were various attempts by various popes in Rome to reconquer the Eastern Church that had made a schism, or a great schism, as it's called in the church history, between Rome and the Eastern Orthodox, as we call it today, churches, from Constantinople to Russia to Serbia to Greece. And the split was on a very fundamental issue. There was a doctrine promulgated by St. Augustine, the North African Catholic theologian, and that was the doctrine of original sin, that every life is born into this world a sinner and guilty before God. And the Eastern Church refused that idea vehemently, to the point where they decided to split with the Church of Rome. And for 1,000 years, that has been a fault line between East and West. You can trace it right down to the present day in the frictions between Catholic Western Europe, or Catholic-dominated European Union, and Russia. All of the conflicts against Russia, or against Serbia in the Yugoslav War back in the 80s, or in the 90s, rather. Or the treatment of Greece in the last 5 years with the financial crisis and the destruction of the Greek nation, the Greek economy. But the war on terror that Bush proclaimed in September 2001 was, in a sense, a crusade, but not quite the way most people would understand it. It was a crusade to create a clash of civilizations, a war between Christian and Muslim, and wars inside Islam itself, to unleash the deepest hatreds and revenge feelings between East and West, Western Christendom and Islam, and also Eastern Orthodoxy. So this is very much what we've seen unfold since 2001. Look at the Arab Spring closely, what I document in my book, The Lost Hegemon. That was an operation to bring a death cult, a Freemasonic-like death cult called the Muslim Brotherhood, by the Obama-Clinton administration when she was Secretary of State, into power throughout the entire Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, was on the hit list of this Arab Spring regime change destabilization from the CIA and the Clinton State Department. So it's very much similar to the Holy Crusades of the Middle Ages. You have slaughter of innocents, looting, wars of unspeakable destruction organized by the West to achieve certain goals, this time for oil, then for control of Palestine and taking that from the Muslims and taking that from the Eastern Constantinople church. So there are many similarities, but the idea of the crusade, killing heretics for Christ, holy war versus jihad. You know, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux was the patron saint of the crusades. He recruited illiterate peasants from France and all over Europe to join this crusade, and he preached that this was a war. If you kill heretic Muslims, or Saracens, they called them, then you would be saved. You would have a special dispensation from Christ in the church. And, of course, people joined in the hundreds of thousands and looted everything on the way from continental Europe down through the Balkans into Constantinople. Not much different from what Washington is doing in the Middle East today, in Syria, in Libya, and other places.
So would you say that ultimately the goals of both were similar in terms of looting and stealing resources rather than religion?
Very much. Very much. And it's a question of political power. Because as long as a different political power with a religious split schism to Rome was in control of the wealth of what today is Turkey, what then is Constantinople and the Eastern Empire, that had to be destroyed. That had to be challenged as the Vatican and the financial interests behind the Vatican saw.
The Muslim Brotherhood was born in Egypt right after the First World War, according to your book. How did World War I and its aftermath serve as an incubator for the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood emerged out of Egypt in 1926-28, in that period, as a secret society with a public facade of doing good works, service, they call it. And the hidden agenda was a assassin's cult, a military arm of the Brotherhood that uses all means necessary to come to power where possible. And their structure, everything they do reminds me very much of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, which maybe is not an accident, but be that as it may. So the Brotherhood in Egypt grew up out of the resentment of the betrayal in World War I by the British and by the West, the so-called Christians, of the Muslims, of the Muslim world. Instead of giving the different countries, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and so forth, freedom and independence, which is what the British and the French promised. The British and the French had a secret agreement called Sykes-Picot. At the time, Tsarist Russia was a partner to that, but after the Bolshevik Revolution, they revealed the secrets. The Sykes-Picot divided the entire former lands of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. So Syria, for example, at that point became French, as did Lebanon. Transjordan, or what we know today as Jordan, became a British, and the King of Jordan to this day has ties with the British elites that are very, very deep, to put it mildly. Palestine, what Halford Mackinder, the father of British geopolitics, called the greatest gain of the British Empire in the First World War, Palestine became a League of Nations protectorate of Great Britain, so Britain could control that pivotal area in the whole region. And Iraq became British. Now, the British knew. There's an article I published in my book, The Century of War. I published the picture from this article in May, I believe it was, of 1914, before the First World War, and it was a picture from a British oil magazine of the oil fields of Iraq, or at that point it was Mesopotamia as a province of the Ottoman Empire, and the oil fields of Mosul and all these areas, Kirkuk, were known to British geologists at that time. So this enlisting of the House of Saud, the Bedouins in Saudi Arabia, of the Jordanian and other forces against the Germans and against Ottoman Turkey mainly, was betrayed after the war by the carving up of Sykes-Picot. And that created a huge Arab rage and resentment that the Muslim Brotherhood then channeled into its own political agenda. Most Islam before the 1990s around the world was peaceful, was nonviolent, was non-jihadist. They took their faith as their faith, but didn't force anybody to believe it. But after the 90s, the influence of what I call a marriage made in hell, that is the Muslim Brotherhood, back in the early 50s when the CIA had discovered them, first in Germany, back in the early 50s, they made an assassination attempt against Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. And the CIA had to get them out of the country, the leadership of the Brotherhood, and they smuggled them out of Egypt into Saudi Arabia, where the Americans had more or less total control over the royal family. And the deal was that the Muslim Brotherhood would be given support, sanctuary. They would become professors at the religious universities of fundamentalist Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, the most primitive, bestial, I don't know what you want to call it, religion, of the 17th century Bedouin camel herders. And these are the ones that smash statues, that rob the bones out of the grave of the Prophet Muhammad, because graves were a sacrilege in their view. And the rights of women are non-existent because women are simply property of their husbands, their things. So this wonderful humanistic brand of Islam called Wahhabism in the Saudi kingdom was married with the Muslim Brotherhood, which had a political, evangelical recruiting ideology. So Saudi oil money, beginning in the 1950s, began to finance creation of entities like the Muslim World League in Jihad and Riyadh. And the Muslim World League was the missionary arm, like the Mormons or something like that, I guess, the missionary arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, going with Saudi oil money into Pakistan, into Afghanistan, and any place it could get its foot in the door. And that's, by the way, the background of the Mujahideen in the beginning of the 1980s with the CIA against the Soviet Red Army.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Engdahl. Today's show, The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. How was it that Germany in the 30s or the 40s, a Nazi Germany, hooked up with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt? How did that happen?
It happened because the Brotherhood came to Berlin. They were on the hit list of the British, who controlled Egypt at that time for various reasons, and were forced into exile. So they went, my enemy's enemy is my friend, they went to Berlin, including the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and then the Nazis realized that the hate that these brothers had against infidels, and infidels for them were communists, they were anybody who didn't follow their line of psychopathy or sociopathy, that could be used as a weapon against the Soviet Union. So they created a division of the SS made up only of Muslim Brotherhood, recruited from the Islamic parts of the Soviet Union, who had many arguments with Stalin's hard-handed policies.
So then did Germany use the Muslim Brotherhood to attack parts of Russia?
Of the Soviet Union, yes, most definitely.
Now, how was that accomplished?
Well, they created a division of the SS, the feared SS, called the Hanchar Division, which was entirely made up of Muslim Brotherhood. They had these special hats that Muslims wore in those days, and then a Nazi swastika on the hats. And then they went at it like the Tatars. You know, these are famed Muslim warriors that sometimes work with Russia, sometimes work against it. They recruited them, and Himmler said, these Muslims are the most crazy, ferocious fighters we've ever seen. So anyone welcome if they want to kill the communists, as Himmler saw it.
Well, then how did the CIA hook up with the Muslim Brothers?
It happened after the end of the war. The CIA station chief in Munich, Germany, of all places, where Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe were set up by the CIA to broadcast into communist Eastern Europe during the Cold War, they discovered this organization that the Nazis had created of the Muslim Brotherhood, but the Nazis had created it, and the head of it was in Munich, not in prison, but in Munich after the war. And they contacted him and began to get in contact with his network. And then first they used them as propaganda broadcasters in their native tongues in Chechen and Dagestani and Uzbeki and so forth in the Soviet Union. And then the more they had contact with the mother organization of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt at that time, they brought them to Washington to meet with President Eisenhower. In one case, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna was in this famous meeting. And the CIA took a deeper look at this phenomenon and said, I think we can do business with them. And from that time, the CIA and the Muslim Brotherhood have been inseparable. I don't know a better way to describe it.
Well, would you say then that the American CIA have been using the Muslim Brotherhood in the same way that Nazi Germany was employing them?
Very much so. Very much so. You can take, for example, Afghanistan. Afghanistan, the Mujahideen, most people have heard that expression. Mujahideen were supposedly nationalist Afghan fighters who wanted to rid Afghanistan of the Soviet occupation after 1979. An occupation, by the way, which Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, admitted in a French magazine interview years later, was his idea, that he said, if we support these mujahideen in Afghanistan with weapons and so forth, we will provoke a situation where most likely the Soviet Red Army will be forced to intervene to support their pro-Russia government, pro-Soviet government. And at that point, we will demonize the Soviet Union and start a major Vietnam. He called it Russia's Vietnam in Afghanistan. And that's very much what happened. It took 10 years. It was the biggest covert operation to that point in CIA history. And it used Muslim Brotherhood jihadists that Osama and his network out of Saudi Arabia had created. And the interesting point is the person chosen to recruit Islamic jihadists from all over the Islamic world, fanatics, suicidal fanatics, was chosen by the U.S. CIA and by the head of Saudi intelligence, who worked closely with the CIA, and his name was Osama bin Laden. And bin Laden was sent to Pakistan, where he set up a recruitment station, which was called in Arabic, the base, Al-Qaeda. And the base was the data bank of all these Muslim Brotherhoods that Osama's networks had recruited to come and fight the holy war against the infidel Russian soldiers in Afghanistan. It took 10 years and they did it. And then after the collapse of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, when they raised the red flag in 1989, the Soviet Union was forced to collapse at that point. The CIA flew the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood by covert airline into Azerbaijan, which had declared independence of the Soviet Union and happened to be the site of the Baku oil, the huge oil reserves of the Caspian Sea. And they made a coup d'etat, the Muslim Brotherhood networks made a coup d'etat against the Russian-friendly, let's say, because it was the Russian Federation under Yeltsin, the Russian-friendly leadership in Azerbaijan, to put in a regime that was corrupted by British Petroleum and the American Rockefeller Oil Companies, ARCO and others, to give the oil rights to Baku to the Anglo-Americans, and those oil transports would go not through a Soviet-era pipeline that the Russians had built from Baku up through Chechnya, which was the shortest route, which is a part today of the Russian Federation, up through Chechnya, predominantly Muslim part of Russia, into central Russia and on to the world market. Instead, they created the Chechen War in the 90s to destabilize and destroy that Russian pipeline through Chechnya from Baku, and then made the argument that a pipeline costing vastly, vastly more had to be built from Baku through Azerbaijan, through Georgia, into Turkey, which is a NATO country. And that's more or less what happened. So the Chechen wars are part of this Muslim Brotherhood CIA unholy alliance. Most terror organizations today, virtually everyone in Iraq and Syria, most every terrorist so-called jihad organization active is a direct descendant of this CIA Muslim Brotherhood operation that developed a military capability with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the 80s.
I think that what is not very well understood, and you bring it out in the beginning of your book, is that what happened after World War I, I can see from what you write why this Muslim Brotherhood would have been created in the first place. It's because of the horrible way the Arabs were treated by Britain particularly, but by the Allies after World War I.
Very much, because you have to have a rage to recruit to a death cult. You can't just recruit people who are fat and happy and whatever you want to call. You know, you have to have rage. You have to have something that you can organize and direct to give it expression. And the rage was at the British betrayal, the Balfour Declaration, which opened Palestine essentially to Jewish settlement that would push out the Palestinians and the Arabs. So that was one betrayal. That was 1916, before the end of the war. The other was Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, British intelligence, who became Arab, quote unquote. He befriended Ibn Saud, the great founder of the House of Saud, the Saud dynasty. And after the war, he said, "I risked the fraud on my conviction that Arab help was necessary to our cheap and speedy victory in the East. Better we win and break our word than lose." And he was the one guiding the Arabs to war against Ottoman Turkey and the British, because the British aim in the Great War was to control the oil riches of the Middle East. The British Navy had, at the beginning or shortly before the war, made a decision to convert the entire Royal Navy, the heart of power of the military projection of the British Empire, from coal to oil, but to have oil, the North Sea wasn't known at that time, to have oil to feed the fleet, they had to have secure supply sources, which meant Kuwait, which meant Saudi Arabia, although that the oil riches there were discovered later, and it meant Iran, where Anglo-Persian Oil Company, later called British Petroleum, was first created. So to control that, they had to control the Middle East, and that's what much of that war was all about.
And, of course, in your book, you talk about how the British had enlisted the help of the Arabs to overthrow the Ottomans and then, of course, turned around and stabbed them in the back with the settlements after World War One. What I thought was quite interesting is that you talked in your book, The Lost Hegemon, about how the British were bringing down the Ottoman Empire by saddling them with debt. And that certainly is what's happening today and ever since with the IMF and the World Bank, etc.
It's the model. It's the model. If you look closely at what the British and French banks did at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the period leading up to World War One, they took the Ottoman Empire, they gave them loans under friendly conditions, it's always the honey trap, and the Sultan needed money, hard currency money, to, you know, to build up his economy, to build up the empire. And then the debt became so much that it was impossible for them to repay. So it's kind of like the model of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF today. So in order to repay the creditor banks of France and the City of London, the creditors established something called the Public Debt Administration. It's a little bit like the Dawes Plan or the Versailles Debt Collection Plan that was imposed on Germany after World War One. But the Public Debt Administration was totally controlling all the finance ministry revenues and had first claim on those revenues. And, you know, the empire was simply being bled under debt slavery through that.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Ingdahl. Today's show, The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And then again, of course, in order to repay the debt, the Ottomans, the Turks, had to change the way they did business with the rest of their empire so that they had to crack down on everybody. And then it created this resentment against Turkey. And so that's obviously why the Arabs were willing to ally with the British during World War One.
Precisely. More than 30 years ago, I was living in New York working as a journalist, and I was researching this period of World War I, and I was in the New York Public Library, and I found documents about British Finance Ministry plans before the war for the carving up of the Ottoman Empire to repay those debts. So this was planned very, very well in advance.
Yeah, that's amazing. These things are so well planned in advance.
The patriarchs or oligarchs or whatever name you want to call these silly people, they have a nose like a beagle for money and where to steal it.
Since we're talking about the history of the Ottoman Empire and, of course, specifically Turkey, could you talk about Fethullah Gulen's worldwide Islamic movement based in Salersburg, Pennsylvania?
Salersburg, Pennsylvania, if you know anything about Pennsylvania, and I've been there quite often, is not exactly what you would think of as the headquarters of a worldwide Islamic terrorist organization. But since 1998, when Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish political cult leader, was forced into exile by the Turkish government for preaching essentially sedition and treason against the Turkish state and institutions. He has been based in Salersburg, Pennsylvania, and he got his base there through the CIA, through a man named Graham Fuller, and the former ambassador to the Ankara, to Turkey, as well as another CIA very senior figure, against the objections, interestingly, of the U.S. State Department, who said Fethullah Gulen is no religious scholar. He has no claim on a special academic scholar visa. He has a fifth grade education. And it's said that he has a worldwide empire worth billions that are financed in part by drug money. And the fact that the CIA was responsible to get Fethullah Gulen his residency in Salersburg, Pennsylvania, is very much proof that he is an asset of the CIA. He was picked up in right-wing neo-Nazi Turkish networks that the Gladio NATO had created back in the 70s and the 80s in Turkey and all NATO countries. And then he was remodeled, if you want to use the term, into a moderate Islamic scholar, something he never was and never will be, in my view. And he was called Imam, but he's no Imam. He even renounced the title. It means teacher. But it sounded very holy at the time. And on his website, he talks about the Sufi tradition of moderate Islam. He even made a photo opportunity with Pope John Paul II before his death that he predominantly displays on his website. So people say, oh, this is really a man of multicultural understanding and inclusiveness and so forth. That's the cover. In reality, Gulen worked with the CIA to set up madrasas immediately when the Soviet Union collapsed. The Gulen organization went in with a lot of money, believed to be, keep in mind, from the drug trade. They went into the entire Turkic belt, which historically goes from Turkey up through into the western part of China called Xinjiang province, where the Uyghurs, the Turkic Uyghurs, who call themselves East Turkestan, by the way. So this whole belt of Islam from Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, on down to Turkey was being opened, and suddenly Fethullah Gulen's organization began setting up schools with teachers. And in one case, according to the former head of the Turkish CIA, a nationalist, there were 500 CIA agents in Gulen schools in the former Soviet Union who were listed as native-speaking English teachers, and they all carried diplomatic passports. Well, I used to be a native-speaking English teacher years ago, and no one offered me a diplomatic passport. They were CIA agents. That's what this former head of Turkish intelligence described in his memoirs. So Gulen not only was active in the former Soviet Union trying to create Islamic chaos and agitation, but his main focus was in Turkey. And there he made a deal with the man who was to become prime minister and most recently president of Turkey, Recep Erdogan. And the deal was the then very influential organization of Fethullah Gulen called SEMAT in Turkish, or service, would give its support, its base, to support the AK party, the AKP of Erdogan in the elections and get them into power. But in return, Gulen's people demanded free rein to control the education ministry of Turkey, to control appointments of judges in the judiciary in Turkey, and the national police as well. It turns out in the aftermath of the failed coup d'etat of July by Gulen's people, the army, the heart of the Ataturk secular Turkey from the end of World War I. And what they were about was essentially a CIA-directed takeover of the Turkish state. And at a certain point, not a case of good guy versus bad guy, but at a certain point, Erdogan, who's very jealous of his power, realized that Gulen wanted to take control over everything. He wanted control of the Turkish CIA, the MIT. And that was in 2013. So there came this confrontation over a park in Istanbul, a historic park where the Erdogan government wanted to construct a modern shopping plaza, shopping mall. And Gulen opposed Erdogan at this point, but the real issue was his control of the CIA in Turkey. So from that point on, there was this open split. Now, in July of this year, July 15th, in fact, there was a attempted coup d'etat against the Erdogan rule in Turkey. Keep in mind, Erdogan is no saint. His focus is power, the power of Erdogan. But his focus is the power of Erdogan. He's very concentrated on that. And he realized that a coup d'etat was being launched. And he was told, according to various reports, by Russian intelligence through Iranian or other intermediaries, that within a few hours, his resort hotel where he was on holiday with his family would be invaded by coup helicopters, and he would be taken prisoner and shot. And he fled to another location and managed to broadcast to the nation the broadcast saying, Turkish people take to the streets to defend your country against the CIA coup d'etat led by Fethullah Gulen. And that happened. I mean, that's a matter of record. Some people say this was a fake attempt by Erdogan. I don't think it was. I think it was genuine. And Graham Fuller, the mentor of Fethullah Gulen, was in Istanbul on an island at a conference 20 minutes boat ride away from the center of Istanbul on the night of the coup d'etat. So this was very much a CIA-sponsored attempt. And it happened weeks after Erdogan made a 180-degree foreign policy shift away from the NATO line against Assad in Syria and against Russia by shooting down the Russian jet. And he realized that he had been trapped in a dead-end corner, and he began making overtures toward reconciliation with Putin and with China. And to the surprise of the West, Russia began a back-channel dialogue that led to a reopening of relations. And when that happened, the CIA went into high-speed panic. And I think that is the background of the attempted coup d'etat.
I remember that some people were trying to claim that Erdogan had staged the coup himself and that it was all fake. But in your opinion, it was a real coup, and the Russians actually tipped off Erdogan, right?
Well, if that had not happened and Erdogan had been captured and murdered, the coup would have succeeded. It wasn't a completely amateurish attempt at all. So, and the fact that Graham E. Fuller and a CIA colleague of his, Henry Markey, who, by the way, is or was a professor at a university 20 minutes car drive from the compound of Fethullah Gulen in Salisbury, Pennsylvania, interesting, they were having a CIA conference on the night of the coup. In other words, monitoring the whole process. And that's not a coincidence, I don't think. And both Graham E. Fuller and Henry Markey made vehement denunciations of charges that they were involved in the coup. Well, a CIA leading figure like Graham E. Fuller, who's architect of the Iran-Contra scam and various other things, and the patron of Fethullah Gulen, you don't go public and deny anything because it says, methinks thou doth protest too much, Mr. Fuller. He did the same thing with the Boston Massacre, where the two patsies for the Boston Massacre, so-called, the Boston Marathon bombing, were nephews of the son-in-law of Graham E. Fuller, who married Fuller's daughter. So this is a very tight-knit little intimate network of nastiness, I think. And the CIA was involved in it. That when this came out about the son-in-law of Graham Fuller being the uncle of these two kids, Graham Fuller held a press conference to deny any connection to this. Again, you know, the man has so much blood on his hands, he can't help but say, I'm guilty, I'm guilty, I'm guilty. By claiming he's innocent, he's innocent, he's innocent.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Ingdahl. Today's show, The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Is there a relationship between the international Gulen movement and the Muslim Brotherhood?
The Gulen movement is the Muslim Brotherhood in the Turkish world. The Turkic people are not Arabs. The Muslim Brotherhood is Sunni Arab. So the Turkish version of the Muslim Brotherhood is the Gulen movement, essentially. Sunni, pro-death culture, but Turkic. So you couldn't have an al-Baghdadi fictional leader of the Turkish Islamic movement. You had to have a Turk, because they're very nationalistic, very ethnically oriented.
Let's bring the Muslim Brotherhood up to date in present time with regard to ISIS, for instance. How did ISIS, or the Islamic State, develop out of al-Qaeda and the Mujahideen?
The al-Qaeda, which grew up, as I said earlier, in Pakistan to fight this Mujahideen holy war against the Soviet Red Army throughout the 1980s, Osama bin Laden's organization, they were flown or transported by the CIA, the leadership, into the former Soviet Union and into Bosnia-Herzegovina in the U.S. breakup of what was called Yugoslavia back in the early 90s. And then they, because they were Arabs, they were predominantly Arabs recruited by Osama, in the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. in 2003, they were brought into Iraq, and General David Petraeus was instrumental in working with the Sunni networks to get this hatred stirred up that was connected with the Muslim Brotherhood and Sunni against Shia. And so there was Al-Qaeda in Iraq that was established, and soon it transformed into an affiliate in Syria called Al-Qaeda in Syria, and then it became Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria. And then at a certain point, the CIA decided to change the name. They trained these cadre in a secret NATO base in Turkey, among other places, and also in Jordan. They needed a new organization to continue the war against Bashar al-Assad. So they called it the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS. And then someone pointed out, some Israeli journalists, that ISIS is another abbreviation for the Israeli Mossad, so that might not be too good an abbreviation, so they called it the Islamic State. But it's a U.S. Mossad and Turkish intelligence operation with money from Saudi Arabia and from Qatar, Kuwait, perhaps also the Emirates, certainly, but Qatar, where the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood sits presently. And it's about oil and gas war pipelines, pipeline wars, because Syria refused in 2009 to let Qatar run a gas pipeline from Qatar's huge gas field in the Persian Gulf through Syria into Turkey and on to the European Union, the huge gas market consumers over the next 20 years in the world. So in a sense, this very much is a war in Syria or over Syria about control of pipelines for energy.
You write in The Lost Hegemon that behind every Arab Spring regime change from Tunisia to Egypt to Libya and later to Syria, one organization invariably emerged out of the shadows to push aside the poorly organized democratic protesters and to take center stage. That organization was the Muslim Brotherhood. How much of the Arab Spring do you think was orchestrated by the U.S.?
All of it. Every single bit of it. I've detailed this in my writings and in my books.
But now, how do you square that with democratic protesters? I mean, probably most of the people demonstrating in these countries had very real aspirations. They weren't all just puppets of the CIA.
Of course not. Otherwise, these things wouldn't work. The CIA created something in 1983. Bill Casey was Reagan's head of CIA, and George Bush, the vice president, former director of CIA, worked on this, called the National Endowment for Democracy. And the idea was to have NGOs, so-called private NGOs, not traceable directly to the CIA, to do these destabilizations. And they would do it under the name of democracy. And they would bring to Washington or bring to Belgrade, where CANVAS, the organization that came out of the regime change destabilization of Milosevic in the 1990s, in Serbia, they would train certain pre-picked student activist leader types and send them back to lead essentially color revolutions in these countries. So this was done in China in the Tiananmen Square operation of Bush Sr. with the CIA in 1989. You get hundreds of thousands of students and you profile them psychologically what the issue is that they'll respond to. I know students who were active in the Egyptian color revolution, and they believed that this was genuine, spontaneous grassroots. That's the purpose of the whole thing, to make it that. But the reality is what happened after the collapse of Mubarak. Those students and their democratic, lovely thoughts vanished, and the Muslim Brotherhood, they took over, not the students.
But then Morsi was overthrown by, what's his name, al-Sisi?
Al-Sisi, yeah, the military, essentially, because the military realized that what was on the agenda would take away all their power. Al-Sisi, ironically, was supported by the Saudi government because the Saudis realized the Muslim Brotherhood of Obama and Hillary Clinton was aimed at Saudi Arabia as well. They were starting to get very active inside Saudi Arabia. So rather than let Morsi and the Muslim Brothers establish a launching base in Egypt, they financed al-Sisi to make essentially a coup d'etat, although they don't like to call it that. But the students, in every case, there's a man named Gene Sharp. He's deceased now, but he was in Boston and created something that worked with the CIA and the Pentagon since 1983 called the Albert Einstein Institution. And he did a years-long study of, by the way, the name of the Albert Einstein had nothing to do with the scientist. It just, he confessed years later that it sounded serious, so he took it. He studied nonviolent revolutions from Gandhi and so forth and said this can be a weapon that the U.S. government can use for regime change. And give credit where credit is due, he was a clever guy. He put it into a handbook of ABCs that was then translated into the languages of every country that had these color revolutions. One of the key points was to make a monkey out of the ruling dictatorship, and that's usually fairly easy to do, but you do it through social media and other things. And then once you do that, you get the population on your side and you build it into a complete regime change like you had against Mubarak in Egypt.
What I don't understand about the CIA or the U.S. being behind these color revolutions, and I'm not referring to the Ukraine here or Eastern Europe or anything like that, but in the Arab world, what would have been the point of getting rid of Mubarak or the head of Tunisia? And, of course, Gaddafi, etc. It all seems fairly crazy to me. It didn't work out for them at all, did it?
No, it didn't. Most of these things don't work out for them. They're a little bit stupid. But that's my personal opinion. But the triangle that you mentioned, Mubarak in Egypt, Ben Ali, the president of Tunisia, they were all dictators, no question about it. But these are dictatorial cultures. Gaddafi in Libya was chosen by the tribal elders in a process that took 15 years for them to come to a consensus before he became the supreme leader of Libya. But the three of those countries, and this came out in emails that WikiLeaks released from Hillary Clinton, those three countries in particular were about to launch something called the Golden Dinar Islamic Bank, Central Bank, and that the oil, especially of Libya, would be sold on the world market only in exchange for golden dinar, not for dollars. And if the idea of this gold-backed currency were to spread throughout the oil-rich Muslim world, Arab world, this would have been catastrophe for the U.S. dollar.
Yes, that's right. I remember all of that now. That makes total sense.
But there's, you know, there's more to it. It's simply, for example, Syria has some of the largest oil reserves in the world that are undeveloped. Syria has huge natural gas reserves that are undeveloped. So if those reserves get linked to a triangle called Iran and Russia and China, that's a huge disadvantage for the Anglo-American oil power. So all of these things kind of came into play, and the idea of Dick Cheney's London 1999 speech to the Institute of Petroleum is the problem of these countries in the Middle East, where all the oil reserves are, and today you would say gas reserves also, is that the energy companies are in state ownership and not private. Private meaning ExxonMobil. Private meaning British Petroleum. Private meaning Chevron. Private meaning Shell. So I think that's also what the Arab Spring is all about.
William Engdahl, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. I very much enjoyed another chat with you. And I hope your listeners also. And thank you again.
Is something happening? Yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with F. William Engdahl. Today's show has been The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the power of oil, food, and money control. His book, Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Visit WilliamEngdahl.com to sign up for a free bi-monthly geopolitical newsletter with significant content. He is launching a new monthly subscription audio seminar. That's WilliamEngdahl.com, WilliamEngdahl.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to installment 353 of New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll look at crimes that get punished and crimes that don't. Who gets away with murder and who gets the book thrown at him? Speaking of books, this installment is titled Crime and Punishment, and I hope you'll stay tuned. It's been a quiet week in Manchester, my adopted town. But last Tuesday, things were jumping at the courthouse. My teenaged son had to be at the courthouse last Tuesday evening. Actually, it was just for a mock trial tournament for high school students. So we were surprised to find TV news reporters from a Hartford station speaking into TV cameras in front of the courthouse. Seemed a bit much for a high school debate exercise, but what do I know about TV news these days? I threw away my television set sometime back in Bill Clinton's first term. I didn't own a shotgun back then. That's how folk singer Utah Phillips disposed of his TV set. He told the story later to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Utah said he put a blindfold on his TV. Then he taped a last cigarette to its picture tube. Then he blasted the set to Kingdom Come with his 12-gauge shotgun. This was well before LED flat screens, keep in mind. TVs had a huge vacuum-filled glass picture tube. I imagine the TV made a most satisfying sound as the buckshot penetrated its vitals and the big picture tube imploded, sending little pieces of glass and metal flying in every direction. If you try this at home, remember, always handle firearms with great care. Keep your finger off the trigger until ready to fire. Be sure to wear appropriate eye and ear protection. Choose a backstop that will minimize ricochets. And before proceeding, check local ordinances pertaining to firearms discharge in your neighborhood. But, as I said, I never shot a TV set myself. All credit goes to Utah Phillips. But I digress. To return to the story, the 5 o'clock dim witness news team was yakking away in front of the courthouse in Manchester because, it turns out, some trial of popular interest had just concluded. I think that trial is worth comparing and contrasting with some other trials in the news. Old trials, future trials, and trials that will never happen. One inevitable comparison is with the trial that will never happen in Ferguson, Missouri. As you recall, a white cop shot and killed Michael Brown. Black, unarmed, apparently neither attacking the cop nor fleeing, apparently with his hands raised in surrender. Though that last point is not entirely certain. But officials have found that there is no reason even to charge the officer who shot Brown with any crime. No reason even to have a trial. In New York City, in July, police confronted a man on a sidewalk. They accused him of selling unpackaged cigarettes, which is illegal in New York. The man's name was Eric Garner, and he was black. I just saw a video of the stop taken by a passerby. For no discernible reason, the white police officer suddenly lunged at Garner, grabbed him, and put him in what appears to be a chokehold. The New York Police Department prohibits chokeholds. The officer took Garner down to the sidewalk. Other white cops joined in, holding Garner down on a sidewalk, still apparently in a chokehold. Garner cried out, "I can't breathe," at least 11 times, as the cops choked him. He died. On December 4, the grand jury decided that there was not enough evidence of wrongdoing even to charge the cops with any crime. This happens so often, it makes one's head spin, just trying to remember the names of all the victims. There was the unarmed man in Oakland, California, New Year's Day 2009, arrested for no probable cause in a subway station. The arresting officer, a transit authority cop, made the unarmed man lie face down on the floor. The cop then shot the man in the back, killing him. The deceased's name was Oscar Grant III. This officer was tried and convicted of a relatively minor crime, involuntary manslaughter. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison, less time already served. Then there was the young black man stopped on a marijuana-related allegation in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Police searched him twice, handcuffed him, hands behind his back, and put him into the back seat of a police cruiser. Someone then shot a bullet through his head. The state medical examiner ruled the death a suicide. Now this blows my mind. I couldn't remember the victim's name, so I did a Google search on shot in police car. Eventually, I found the one I was looking for. His name was Chavis Carter. Died July 29, 2012. But there's more. There was also Charles Smith, a black man in Savannah, Georgia, also shot with his hands cuffed behind his back inside a police car in September 2014. Police are investigating. March 2014, and there was Victor White III, also black, handcuffed behind his back inside a police car in Iberia Parish, Louisiana, shot and killed. The police say that White killed himself, shot himself in the back. The parish coroner found that actually White, hands cuffed behind his back, was shot from the front. The coroner ruled it a suicide anyway. He did not test White's hands to see if they had any gunpowder residue, according to reports. Durham, North Carolina, November 2013. 17-year-old Jesus Huerta, hands cuffed behind his back and in the back seat of a police car, died of a close-range gunshot wound to the head. An investigation by the police ruled the death a suicide and cleared the arresting officers of any wrongdoing. Golly, there seems to be a rash of suicides by handcuffed young men of color inside police cars these days. Did you ever hear of a white guy committing suicide by shooting himself while handcuffed in the back seat of a police car? Okay, agents of the state get away with bloody murder over and over and over again. And so do the giant corporations. If a blue uniform is a really good get-out-of-jail-free card, an expensive gray suit is even better. December 2nd to 3rd, 2014, was the 30th anniversary of the criminal explosion at Bhopal in 1984. The culprits at Union Carbide and its subcontractor didn't get off entirely free. There were a handful of small fines and a few short prison sentences. 2014 not only marks the 30th anniversary of Bhopal, it is also the 35th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant snafu, and the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez disaster. That latter one is rife with unpunished criminal felonies by Exxon and its partner BP. You may have heard that name before in connection with maritime disasters, BP. The one small bit of good news this month is that a federal prosecutor has just filed criminal charges against Donald Blankenship, the now retired former CEO of the notorious and murderous coal mine company, Massey Energy. The charges are more symbolic than useful, but these days, even a whiff of justice smells pretty refreshing. We'll return to Blankenship in a minute. Now, back to the courthouse in Manchester, Connecticut. Remember that? In May of 2013, there had been a party nearby full of teenagers. Some of them were smoking marijuana. An 18-year-old girl, who had a puff or two, and four other teenagers, left the party, got into the girl's SUV, and sped off to fetch something. And I do mean sped off. In the nearby mostly rural town of South Windsor, they were driving 85 to 90 miles an hour. The car went over a big bump in Abbey Road, went flying, and smashed into a tree. Two of the four teenage passengers were killed. So that's what the big to-do at the Manchester courthouse was on December 2nd, the conclusion of the girl's trial. She pled guilty and was convicted of two counts of second-degree manslaughter with a motor vehicle and two counts of second-degree assault with a motor vehicle, one count for each passenger. Her attorney pleaded for leniency, the newspaper reports. He said, "This was someone who wanted to fit in, and under peer pressure and immaturity, made a bad decision." But the prosecutor pressed for the maximum sentence of 12 years in prison. He argued that the crash was not an accident because the girl knowingly drove the car after smoking marijuana. "She had every reason to know her behavior was wrong," said prosecutor Adam Scott. Judge Laura Baldini sentenced the girl to 8.5 years in prison, plus additional probation, mental health treatment, and substance abuse treatment. And the girl is required to speak out about the dangers of driving under the influence. That's on top of the 8.5 years. Yes, the convicted girl has a name, and it is in the public record. I'm keeping her anonymous anyway, 'cause darned if I can see any large difference between her and most other teenagers I've met. And I'm teaching 49 of them this semester. Now, clearly, the girl was immature and foolish and irresponsible, and two people died as a result. And convicting her of some crime seems reasonable. But 8.5 years in prison for causing two deaths through stupidity, but quite unintentionally? Whose crime was worse, that of the girl or the cop who shot Michael Brown in Ferguson? Or the cop who strangled Eric Garner for selling cigarettes in New York? Or all the cops whose prisoners somehow shot themselves while handcuffed in the back seat of a police car? One of these perps is getting 8.5 years for manslaughter. All the others don't even have to face a trial. Or take Donald Blankenship, rich mine owner, famous for sneering at safety laws and laughing at citations for mine safety violations. In so doing, he killed many, many miners, including his final big haul, 29, at Big Branch Mine in West Virginia, 2010. He has just now been indicted for some of his past crimes, and we'll see if he serves more than 4 years in prison for each person he killed. More of that coming up. Here's Ann Feeney.
Heard 16 tons in the coal tattoo. In the coal field, danger is nothing new.
question I'm putting to you. How much for the life of a miner? It should come as no surprise. You'll hear them spout the same old lies. Every time a miner dies. How much for the life of a miner? Somewhere far away from here, accountants will project. Actuaries speculate on causes and effect. No pesky regulations from the thieves that they elect. And auditors confirm the yield from their benign neglect. Each state sets a price for a leg that's lost. Lose an arm or an ear, there's a preset cost. When the air goes bad and there's no exhaust. Oh, how much for the life of a miner? A slap on the wrist or a paltry fine? Reversed on appeal on down the line. An act of God, the courts opine. How much for the life of a miner? Politicians posture at the mine face solemnly. Live reporters swarm like flies around the tragedy. Preachers will proclaim the Lord behaves mysteriously. And PR spokesmen orchestrate deniability. And now their widows, sons and daughters come to you and me. And ask how much for the life of a miner. How much for the life of a miner.
And Feeney. So, at the end of November, a rare bit of good news emerged about the Federal Justice Department. In West Virginia, a federal prosecutor finally filed criminal charges against Donald Blankenship, former CEO of Massey Energy. Massey owned coal mines and was notorious for ignoring or contesting the company's many, many citations for violating mine safety laws and regulations. We're talking about flagrant, hazardous violations, not trivia. In 2010, the Big Branch mine in West Virginia simply exploded. 29 miners were killed in the explosion and the subsequent fireball, fed by unsafe and illegal buildups of coal dust and methane gas. For this crime, the company and all of its executives have so far gotten off entirely scot-free. In its November report, the grand jury reported that several managers at the Big Branch mine had notified the company that illegal and hazardous conditions were in the mine. Not only coal dust, but methane gas buildup, and flooding, and more. But Blankenship personally ordered the managers to ignore every hazard and maximize production at the mine. He threatened to fire the managers if production dipped in the least. Coal dust is not only an explosive, but a terrible health hazard. It causes the fatal disease black lung. Autopsies of the incinerated mine workers in 2010 found that 71% of them had black lung disease. 71%. The industry average is 3.2%. All of this information courtesy of the New York Times, December 1, 2014. Blankenship retired soon after the explosion at the end of 2010. The previous year, his salary had been $18 million. On his retirement, in addition to his salary and benefits, he received severance payments of $12 million, plus $120,000 in fees for future consulting, plus undisclosed payments from 5 different incentive plans. Plus, he received a pension valued at $5.7 million. That adds up to at least $18 million, maybe more. That's a nice going-away present. Sure beats burning to death in a fireball, or choking to death from black lung. Incidentally, none of the newspaper reports I read thought to mention that the workers at Big Branch Mine did not have a union to protect them, which means they had nobody to protect them. Certainly not the high officials at the state of West Virginia, who were not going to let some grumbles from the rabble interfere with Don Blankenship and his campaign contributions and the profits of Massey Energy Company. Indicting Blankenship 25 years ago would have made a difference, but now it's mostly just symbolic. Blankenship is retired and living in Las Vegas. Massey Energy is now run by other people, and American mines are still the most unsafe in the developed world. Okay, there's my highly selective survey of the crime scene today, and my jaundiced eye view of who gets jailed, who gets slapped on the wrist, and who doesn't even get charged with a crime. On a quick glance, it sure looks like the state security apparatus has a license to kill at whim, especially if they're killing poor and or black people. And it looks like big corporations have a license to kill. And, in so doing, they are generally protected by the government. But if you're nobody important and you kill somebody, like the girl in South Windsor, justice requires some serious jail time for you. All right, maybe you knew this all along. But how about a really radical perspective on the problem? We'll hear one from Glenn Ford. While the 5 o'clock dim witness news was reporting on the teenager from South Windsor, the station almost certainly said nothing about a new report from a UN commission on torture. The UN criticized the United States government for torture and for failing to investigate torture and for failing to prosecute U.S. torturers. The radical thing here is that the UN Commission considered the U.S.'s brutal police and brutal prison conditions to be a part of the government's torture system. And Glenn Ford entirely agrees. He spoke after the police killed Michael Brown in Ferguson and before the police killed Eric Garner in New York. Here is Glenn Ford.
Over the past 4 months, the world has come to know the name of Ferguson and rendered its own verdict on the U.S. criminal justice system. In addition to protests in nearly 200 American cities since the non-indictment of the cop that killed Michael Brown, demonstrations were staged in solidarity with U.S. blacks in at least 8 cities in Canada, as well as Japan, England, Scotland, and Norway. Last week, a United Nations committee registered its objections to U.S. treatment of blacks. The UN Committee Against Torture's latest report largely focused on the Obama administration's failure to punish the torture of detainees in places like Guantanamo Bay and in CIA interrogation sites around the world. But it also warned Washington that its policing policies in black America are not in compliance with international treaties against torture. The committee's findings are a great embarrassment to the planet's sole superpower, which justifies its military adventures around the world by virtue of its claims to moral exceptionalism. based on 2 days of testimony by U.S. human rights activists last month in Geneva, Switzerland, the committee concluded that solitary confinement as practiced in the United States constitutes torture, that some conditions in U.S. prisons also fit the definition of torture, and that when police target African Americans on the street for abuse, beatings, tasering, and death by gunfire, they are guilty of torture. Moreover, if the United States does not provide remedies and compensation for the victims of torture at the hands of its cops and prison guards, then the nation is in violation of its international treaty obligations, which is legally the same thing as violating U.S. law. Not only does the U.S. fail to provide either remedies or compensation for those it tortures, U.S. law does not even define what torture is or set any standard to measure it, which shows conclusively that no American government has ever seriously considered doing away with torture, certainly not torture of black people. The UN committee was clearly quite impressed with a delegation of young activists from Chicago who testified under the banner "We Charge Genocide." The committee included much of the group's requests in its report, including investigation of police torture by outside institutions, prosecution of police who torture, and reparations for those who survive police torture in Chicago. The UN committee is most concerned that countries establish remedies to torture in all its deadly forms. But remedies are precisely what the United States refuses to offer to black people. No punishment for the cops, no compensation for their millions of victims, and no fundamental change in a system born in slavery and genocide. Under these circumstances, there is only one remedy: the overthrow of the system itself and the destruction, root and branch, of the mass black incarceration state, which must be the goal of this new movement in the making that still has no name other than Ferguson. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
One final footnote. In New York, police have arrested the man who shot the video of police choking Eric Garner to death. They also arrested the videographer's wife. Most of this program was recorded in December 2014. Here's a quick update. In December 2015, for incinerating 29 miners in Big Branch Mine, former Massey Energy executive Donald Blankenship was found guilty of one misdemeanor charge. He was fined $250,000 and sentenced to 1 year in jail. He began serving his sentence in April 2016. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimi non carborundum. Please practice peace and nonviolence. And please come back again next week. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. I attended a civil liberties conference at Central Connecticut State University on March 29th, and although our 9/11 table was well received by many, many of the participants, there was still some glaring opposition, a lot of it from the leadership. In fact, at the beginning of the event, one of the panelists directed the audience not to pay attention to conspiracy theories. So first, let me just say that I really appreciate the efforts of the sponsoring groups to put on the conference. I don't disagree with any of what was said about the need to restore our civil liberties, from the Patriot Act to the National Defense Authorization Act, or to stop the NSA from spying on all of us. It's what they omit that's so puzzling to me. And of course, what they omit is any focus on 9/11 and the 9/11 Truth Movement and the huge and growing body of evidence that totally refutes the official story of 9/11. There were two reasons given to me by people at the conference. One is that 9/11 is a distraction from the real work that has to be done to stop the wars and get our civil liberties back. Now, everyone in the 9/11 Truth Movement, because they know 9/11 was a false flag event, is against the wars, is against the loss of our civil liberties. But don't see 9/11 as a distraction, but as critical to getting our country back. If Muslims didn't do it, and there's ample evidence that they didn't, then the government could not justify their attack on our civil liberties, the vilification of Muslims, the entrapment of them, and their imprisonment on phony charges. And if Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were working for the CIA right up to and after 9/11, and again, there's ample evidence of this, there would be no pretext for all of the wars, drone attacks, or NSA surveillance. So what I don't understand is why people who are working on civil liberties and to stop wars can't also hold in their mental bucket the fact that we've been lied to about 9/11 and that there's a cover-up going on. To see this as a distraction is just really puzzling. Another reason that was given about their resistance to 9/11 is that they don't believe in conspiracies. I had several people refuse to even touch any of the free literature or DVDs we were giving out. It's like they would be labeled a wacky conspiracy theorist if they even touched the literature or anything related to 9/11 truth. All I can say to this is that the government's propaganda and psychological operation when it comes to the term conspiracy theory has been quite successful. These people have been totally manipulated by that term and don't even know it. So there are four reasons why someone would think that 9/11 was not important to look at. One is that they agree with the 9/11 Truth Movement, but are afraid to state that publicly because of the repercussions. I've had several leading people confess this to me. Another reason is that they don't really understand what the 9/11 Truth Movement is all about. They don't understand the mountains of evidence that exist and even what that evidence entails. And they've bought into the power elite's propaganda about conspiracy theories. They don't realize just how many prominent people, scientists, etc., around the world and in the U.S. question the official story, backing it up with evidence. And by the way, the official story is a conspiracy theory itself. And a third possibility is that they don't want to know about this due to psychological resistance, for reasons you'll hear about shortly in the clips that will follow this. And the fourth reason is that the groups may have been heavily infiltrated by the government at the leadership level, and they controlled the dialogue. I'm sure there were people at this conference that fell into all four of those categories. So just imagine what a powerful force we could be if we all united around all of these issues and also included the facts of 9/11. What if guys like Chris Hedges and Cornel West and all these people came out and said, yeah, 9/11 is suspicious and we have a lot of evidence and we want answers? It'd be very powerful.
And the evidence of who really did 9/11 points towards segments of the U.S. government and Israeli intelligence, with some minor roles involving a few other intelligence agencies from other countries. If this is merely considered a distraction, then there's no hope for improving anything. The war on terror, as we know it, appears to be a hoax. If they get away with this, it won't stop there. Indeed, it hasn't stopped there. But I'll stop here for today and share with you this clip from the movie 9/11 Explosive Evidence Experts Speak Out, where the psychologists explain the psychological resistance to the evidence of 9/11. And that'll be followed by a clip on the hoax of domestic terrorism. And these clips come from a previously aired show. So here it is. Today you'll hear an audio clip from mental health professionals about why people are resistant to hearing the evidence that challenges the official story of 9/11. This clip was created by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and includes some of the mental health professionals who have signed their petition for a new investigation. If you've ever tried to explain some of the evidence that challenges the official story of 9/11 to resistant friends or family members, I'm sure you'll find this segment interesting because toward the end, they give some suggestions on how to talk to people about 9/11. That will be followed by a clip on terrorists created by and then caught by the FBI. So let's get started. Here's the clip from the mental health professionals. You'll hear Richard Gage's voice introducing the clip.
Most of us who have lived with the events of 9/11 have, as a result, experienced some kind of trauma. It can be very difficult to come to terms with what actually happened at the World Trade Center. In fact, someone told me recently, "I wouldn't believe what you're telling me even if it were true." Our petition signers, with psychological expertise, have stepped forward to offer their insight. While this segment is clearly outside the knowledge base of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, these experts in psychology highlight their valuable experience for us as to why this evidence can still be so difficult for people to accept.
At this point, we have 9 years of hard scientific evidence that disproves the government theory about what happened on September 11th, and yet people continue to be either oblivious to the fact that this information exists or completely resistant to looking at this information. So the question becomes, why? Why is it that people have so much trouble hearing this information? From my work, I think we would be remiss not to look at the impact of trauma. My name is Marty Hopper, and I'm a PhD clinical psychologist. I've been working and living for the past 30 years here in Boulder, Colorado. For the past 11 years, my work has focused on helping people who have experienced personal trauma. Now, as we know, the horrors of what happened on 9/11 were televised all over the world, and they were televised, in fact, live. We witnessed the deaths of almost 3,000 of our fellow Americans. We know this had a very severe and traumatic impact on a majority of the population. I myself cried for weeks after September 11th. A friend of mine who is a psychologist in practice here in Boulder said that her caseload increased tremendously after 9/11, and people that she hadn't seen in 10 years were coming back into her practice. So I think it's safe to say that collectively as a nation, because of what happened on September 11th, we experienced trauma.
I'm Fran Schur, and I have a master's degree from the University of Colorado. I've had a private practice as a psychotherapist and as a licensed professional counselor for about 20 years. Why do people resist this information, the information that shows that the official story about 9/11 cannot be true? What I've learned is that as humans, each of us have a worldview, and that worldview is usually formed in great part by the culture we grow up in. When we hear information that contradicts our worldview, social psychologists call the resulting insecurity cognitive dissonance. For example, with 9/11, we have one cognition, which is what the official story of 9/11, what our government told us, what our media repeated to us over and over, that 19 Muslims attacked us. On the other hand, we have what scientists, researchers, architects, engineers are now beginning to tell us, which is that there is evidence that shows that the official story cannot be true. So now we've lost our sense of security. We are starting to feel vulnerable. Now we're confused.
9/11 truth challenges some of our most fundamental beliefs about our government and about our country. When your beliefs are challenged or when two beliefs are inconsistent, cognitive dissonance is created. 9/11 truth challenges the beliefs that our country protects us and keeps us safe and that America is the good guy. My name is Bob Hopper, and I have a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Cincinnati. For the past 29 years, I've been a licensed PhD clinical psychologist in Boulder, Colorado. When your beliefs are challenged, fear and anxiety are created. In response to that, our psychological defenses kick in, and they protect us from these emotions. Denial, which is probably the most primitive psychological defense, is the one most likely to kick in when our beliefs are challenged.
I'm Danielle Dupre, PhD, originally from Switzerland, where I studied psychology and psychoanalysis. For the past 15 years, I've been empowering people who have experienced significant trauma. America is a powerful nation. It has never been attacked. We were confident, we felt secure, and all of a sudden that security collapsed. People started to be fearful. With all those rumors, those news, people didn't know what to think about. And it's a very, very uncomfortable state to be in. And eventually, our mind shuts off. Just like when a computer is overloaded, our minds get overloaded. We can't handle it anymore, and we shut down. It's easier to deny it and move on with our lives.
What some of us will tend to do is deny the evidence that's coming our way and stick to the original story, the official story, and to try to regain our equilibrium in that way. Another thing we can do is decide to look at the conflicting evidence and be sincere and be open-minded and look at both sides of the issue and then make up our own mind about what reality is. I'm Dorothy Lorig. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology from the University of Colorado, and I've been practicing reevaluation counseling for over 16 years. If we can think of our worldview as being sort of our mental and emotional home, I think all of us will do just about anything to defend our homes, to defend our families. And so I see that with people, and I saw that with myself when my brother tried to talk with me about it, of don't mess with me, don't mess with my home, don't mess with my comfort with how things are. And about a week later, I read a lengthy article by Professor Griffin about why he believes the official account of 9/11 cannot be true. And it was a very well-researched article. I was in my office at the time. I sat there and I felt my stomach churning. I thought maybe I was going to be sick. And I leaped out of my chair and ran out the door and took a long walk around the block, around several blocks, and just broke down. I understand now that what was happening was my worldview about my government being in some way my protector, almost like a parent, had been dashed, and it was like being cast out into the wilderness, I think is the closest way to describe that feeling. And I sobbed and I sobbed, felt like the ground had completely disappeared beneath my feet. And I knew at some point during the walk that I knew that I was going to have to become active in educating other people about this, that for me to retain any sense of integrity, I was going to have to take some action. I couldn't just let something like this go.
Many people respond to these truths in a very deep way. Some have a visceral reaction like they've been punched in the stomach. To begin to accept the possibility that the government was involved is like opening Pandora's box. If you open the lid and peek in a little bit, it's going to challenge some of your fundamental beliefs about the world.
I'm David Ray Griffin. I taught philosophy of religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. I published about 35 books in my field. But then starting in 2004, I started publishing about 9/11. And since that time, I have published 10 books about 9/11. You have empirical people who will simply say, look at the evidence, and if it's convincing, I will change my mind. Other people are paradigmatic people. They have a paradigm. They say, this is the way the world works, and I'm convinced this is the right way the world works. 9/11 doesn't fit into that paradigm, so I don't need to look at the evidence. It's paradigmatic. And then there is a third type of person that we often call wishful thinkers. I call it wishful and fearful thinking. So they simply will not believe something that they fear to be the truth. And I found that maybe to be the most powerful factor of people rejecting 9/11 truth and not even entertaining the evidence.
So whenever we say, I refuse to believe, we can be sure that the evidence that's coming our way is not bearable and that it's conflicting with our worldview much too much.
Denial protects people from this kind of anxiety.
As I thought about all of these responses, I realized that what is common to every one of them is the emotion of fear. People are afraid of being ostracized, they're afraid of being alienated, they're afraid of being shunned, they're afraid of their lives being inconvenienced, they'd have to change their lives, they're afraid of being confused, they're afraid of psychological deterioration, they're afraid of feeling helpless and vulnerable, and they're afraid that they won't be able to handle the feelings that are coming up. None of us want to feel helpless and vulnerable. So we want to defend ourselves. And the way we often do that is with anger. So then we become angry. And when we become angry, then we become indignant. We become offended. We want to ridicule the messenger. We want to pathologize the messenger. And we want to censor the messenger.
So how can we overcome this resistance and denial? The first thing is to meet people where they're at.
One thing is that we need to raise people's awareness about this through what I would call gentle dialogue and gentle questioning. My name is John Freedom. I'm a counselor in private practice here in Tucson, Arizona, which I've been for the past 20 years. I hold a master's level certification in NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming. So it doesn't work to challenge people's belief or immediately tell them, you know, I know the truth about 9/11, but a good way is to ask questions, ask open-ended questions, and lead them into a dialogue and discussion about it.
Healing comes through facing the truth, experiencing it, allowing the feelings to come in. So that if there are feelings of fear that perhaps these events were caused by something that we haven't thought about yet, dark elements within our society, for example, we'll let that come in and explore it. Let the light shine on whatever happened. This will be the most healing process. The Germans did this after their war. The South Africans did this after apartheid. Reconciliation through the truth is what is a deep path to psychological recovery from the myths and lies around which this historic event has been cloaked in the official view. I am Professor William Woodward. I'm trained in the history of science with a PhD. I also have a master's in experimental psychology. I've edited 4 books and published well over 20 peer-reviewed papers. I've taught for 35 years at a state university, the University of New Hampshire. I think as a psychologist, to overcome our fear of the traumatic event with new information would be the best, healthiest route to our collective recovery from the trauma of 9/11. That, by the way, is a psychotherapeutic insight that to gradually uncover the truth in your own life, the sources of anxiety, to make them conscious, is the royal road to recovery.
One of the ways to deal with the trauma is to find the answers. That's why I think it is of such importance to have a comprehensive investigation?
To work together to expose what happened, regardless of where the evidence takes us. That's what we expect in our state government, law enforcement. I think that by putting science together with the law, we will have a psychological healing around the impossible cognition that has been produced on that day.
I believe that to be the kind of country that we think we are, we have to face some of the things that are not as we think they are. I'm Robert Griffin. I am a licensed psychologist practicing in Pennsylvania for 25 years. I am a member of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, and I am past president of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Psychological Association. After World War II, part of the way that Jewish people honored the dead was by making sure that the truth was known and that the value of these people was respected. Not pursuing the truth about 9/11 disrespects the value of the life of the people that died. Thinking that we're above such things, that it could happen in other countries, but it couldn't happen here, that's a lack of humility, and that's excessive pride. And so not being able to see our dark side or our weaknesses is the most dangerous thing.
The observation that pride is one of the basic human flaws is absolutely correct. This is especially true for Americans because we long, for a long time, looked at other nations and say, oh, they're in such bad shape. But luckily, we don't have those problems. We don't have leaders who would do those things that were done in the Soviet Union or done in Germany or done in Japan and on down the list. So this is a type of pride that Americans have. A feature of American history that makes us particularly liable to this pride is this notion that's called exceptionalism, that America is the exceptional nation. And that began from the beginning. As this country was formed, people would say, well, there was so much evil in the European country, so much cheating, so much lying, so much using the people for the ruler's purposes, but not in America. We have leaders that are free from those sins. So I think this has made 9/11 particularly difficult for Americans.
Anyone can make mistakes, but our ideals and our principles get us back, you know, on track.
This is one of the defining issues of our time.
So we need to understand that questioning is patriotic. Questioning is what we're supposed to do as citizens. That's our duty.
When we come to the national level, when something like 9/11 happens, we need to be sure that we have a real investigation into who the perpetrators are, and then we need to be sure that those perpetrators are held legally accountable. It's part of the healing process on the individual level as on the collective level. We need the truth in order to heal.
And now you're going to hear a recent clip by Judge Napolitano of Fox News telling us about how the FBI sets up its own terrorist attacks and then catches the perpetrators that they set up. I see this as a psychological operation to keep you in fear of domestic and foreign terrorist threats so that you'll support military spending that's more than half of our national budget, and so that you'll support wars, torture, curtailment of your civil liberties, body scanners, surveillance cameras at major traffic lights, all in the name of protecting you from the bad guys who, as it now looks like, were created by and then captured by the FBI. And here's the clip.
Does the government work for us or do we work for the government? Can the federal government take credit for saving us from a plot of its own creation? Tonight, Has the federal government kept us safe, or does it just want us to think that it has kept us safe? Since the tragedy of 9/11, numerous crazies and low-level copycats have engaged in criminal behavior which they hoped would result in the deaths of innocent Americans and somehow advance their cause of jihad. If you ask the leadership of the FBI, most of whose field agents are tireless, dedicated, Constitution-supporting professionals, it will tell you that it, the FBI, has foiled about 17 plots to kill Americans during the past 10 years. What it will not tell you is that there have been 20 foiled plots, and of them, 3 were interrupted by members of the public. The 17 that were interrupted by the feds were created by the feds. We all remember the 3 that were foiled by diligent Americans, the shoe bomber, the underwear bomber, and the Times Square bomber. In all of these cases, the crimes charged were those of attempting to kill and conspiring with others to do so. In all 3 of those cases, alert Americans on transcontinental flights or in the streets of New York City told authorities of bizarre behavior or actually subdued the threats themselves. There was no foiling by the FBI. The plotters were, thankfully, bumbling fools who had poorly planned their criminal behavior and who ended up harming no one. All 3 are serving life terms. But the more curious cases are the remaining 17 for which the federal government has taken credit. They all have a common and reprehensible thread. They were planned, plotted, controlled, and carried out by the federal government itself. In all of these 17 cases, from the Fort Dix 6 to the Lackawanna 7 to the Portland Parade Bomber, the feds found young men of Muslim backgrounds, loners who were bitter at America. They befriended them, cajoled them, and persuaded them that they could change the world by killing Americans. In all these cases, agents worked undercover and portrayed themselves to the targets as Arabs of like un-American mind. In some cases, the federal agents used third parties to act as middlemen. The third parties were typically persons who had been convicted of crimes and who, in return for leniency at their own sentencings, were willing to work with the same feds who prosecuted them in order to help the feds entrap whomever else those feds were pursuing. Thus, in all 17 of these cases, because of the command and control of federal agents, no one was ever in danger, no one was harmed, no bomb went off, and no property was damaged. But in all those cases, the losers whom the feds targeted each believed that they were interacting with real plotters who would bring them cash and bombs. As we know, sometimes the cash arrived, but the bombs never did. The defendants were essentially charged and convicted for playing a game with federal agents. The most recent of those government-generated plots was revealed yesterday. It has a new twist because it allegedly involves agents of the intelligence apparatus of the government of Iran. It, too, was destined to go nowhere as the feds monitored and taped every move made by their target as he interacted with federal agents whom he stupidly believed to be drug dealers and co-conspirators. Today, the feds themselves revealed that high officials of Iran's government knew nothing of this. Of course, the neocons have demanded bombs on Tehran, no matter what the government there knew. And this plot came to light the day before Attorney General Holder himself was subpoenaed by Congress in the Fast and Furious case. You get the picture. Are any of these plots criminal? Can the government just pick and choose whom to seduce and then lower the boom at the right time and arrest its would-be Confederates? Is this a proper and efficient use of law enforcement resources? The answers to these questions are obvious and they are not good. The courts have made this legal, so long as the target of these plots had a mental predisposition to cause harm. But none of this keeps us safe. All of this makes us less free, as any one of us can be entrapped. And we are fools if we praise the government for exposing a plot of its own creation and saving us from a danger that never existed. Can the government break the law in order to enforce it? Well, when it does, it becomes a law unto itself, and the rule of law dies as the feds decide whom to target and whom to trap. Think about it. Are we really safe in a false sense of security? Why do we pay the government to trick us into believing it is keeping us safe? When no one is harmed and the government controls the plot, aren't we just punishing someone for his thoughts? And in a free society, aren't free people free to think as they wish? This must be so. Because if the government can punish our thoughts, there are no limits to its power. From New York, defending freedom every night of the week. So long, America.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. The Reverend William Barber II is the pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina. He's president of the North Carolina NAACP and one of the primary organizers of what's become known as Moral Mondays. The Reverend William Barber is one of the most important social justice leaders in the country today, who speaks in the moral tradition of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He's been prominent on the national stage, calling for racial and economic justice, for immigration reform, for 15 and a union, against police brutality, and at the forefront of mighty rallies, marches, and engaged in civil disobedience in his home state of North Carolina in the battle against homophobia.
The suppression and weakening of the African-American vote, attacks on Medicaid and reproductive rights, and recently against the Republican efforts to legislate a coup that would strip the incoming Democratic governor of political power. To ready ourselves for 2017 and the administration of Donald Trump and its trials and tribulations, we speak with the Reverend William Barber.
And I'm glad to be a part of such a hopeful theme of building bridges and to be with you.
I described you in the moral tradition of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And that is, and one of the things about Dr. King was when he talked about the systemic ills that confront us and the three pillars that held up a system that did not operate for the poor and the oppressed. And that was the issues of war and militarism, the issues of the distribution of wealth, the inequality and the poverty, and the issue of discrimination and unequal treatment, the disparities between people. And I wonder if that's just how I look at love, what I believe you have given to the movements that you have spearheaded, or whether you see that as really part of a prophetic mission to carry forward, which informs the work that you do.
First of all, I'm deeply humbled that to even be mentioned in that category. You know, I'm coming to you and I'm speaking as the president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach, which is an organization we founded to focus on helping to train communities in what I like to call prophetic analysis, articulation, and activism. Dr. King's wells, the wells of his thought, reached very deep. I happen to be a Christian, and I happen to be what I call a theologically evangelical, conservative, liberal, liberationist Christian. In other words, I believe those wells reach all the way back to our most sacred texts. There are 2,000 scriptures in the Bible I read that speak to the issue of poverty and justice and mercy and how you treat the least of these. There is no way to understand my faith tradition without examining where one stands, not on the behalf of, but with those who are on the margins and those who face injustice. Jesus' first sermon started with good news, evangelical, if you will, is for the poor. And the poor there in the Gospel of Luke is the patokos, those who've been made poor by systems of oppression, state-sponsored systems of oppression. During the time of slavery, the abolitionists had deep moral foundations, whether it was Henry David Thoreau or Harriet Tubman, or whether it was Frederick Douglass. They all had deep moral perspectives. The social gospel movement in the late 1800s, early 1900s, looked at inequality and declared that sin was social injustice, and had a great impact on even someone like Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Then you get to the civil rights movement, the same deep moral foundation. So I don't know how to be a person of faith or person of conscience without having a deep concern for justice. Even if you're not a person of faith, our Constitution's first principle says that this country is supposed to be about the establishment of justice, promoting and providing for the common welfare. So what the Moral Monday movement attempts to do is to say there are some things that are far bigger than a left-right argument, a Democrat versus Republican argument, a conservative versus a liberal argument. There are some things that are about right and wrong, and we need to look at policy and raise these three questions. Are these policies constitutionally consistent? Are they morally defensible? And are they economically sound? And when you do that, and you look at some of the places we are right now in our political structure, when you have people who can literally run for office and say, elect me and I'll take your health care, I'll deny you living wages, I'll round up immigrants and take them out of the country, I'll encourage war and nuclear weapons, I'll deny you voting rights, I'll deny basic fundamental human rights. When people can run and actually garner major votes on an agenda like that, it says to me that we have a moral crisis. And if anything, like Dr. King said in 67 at Riverside, we need a massive moral revolution of values in this country.
Building on that, I would like to ask you the tactics and strategy of how we confront Trump in this new era. And do we, in that sense, build upon Dr. King's strategy toward the end of his life, both with regard to the Memphis strike and the Poor People's March, which he was organizing at that time?
I think we have to build on that vision. The vision, as I said, as far as back to the prophets through King and others, you know, Rabbi Heschel, was always that, number one, the first thing you cannot do is sit back when somebody engages in demagoguery, when someone thinks and suggests that because they have elected or selected power, that gives them the right to run roughshod over a people's lives. We have to unmask the myths of injustice. We have to unmask the myths that are being perpetrated right now, particularly by Mr. Trump. You know, a lot of his campaign, as one professor at Princeton said, without Obama, there would be no Trump. For some people, he became kind of a racist response to President Obama, and larger than just to a President Obama. He played all of the cards of the Southern strategy that's been around for 50 years at least, that gets working class and poor white people to vote against their own self-interest. That's the kind of systemic racism that we have to unpack. I've heard people say we have to find a way to reach people that cuts across racial lines. I think that's wrong. You don't need to cut across it. You need to dig down in it and unpack it so that people can see how they're being actually abused. And so, yes, I believe, in fact, at the Metropolitan AME Church in Washington, we are having a national moral revival Poor People's Campaign watch night service. Dr. James Forbes, the Healing of the Nation, is a part of it, and Dr. Blackman and Liz Theo Harris, Dr. Harris at Union with Kairos, and Muslims and Jews and other persons are coming together. And we're saying three things. As we go into this new year, we can't afford to be rejected and dejected. We have to be revived and determined. We have to declare that standing down is not an option. And we have to call on all people of conscience to stand up against extremism that would take our voting rights, take our health care, take our wages, destroy our environment, and on and on and on. Number two, we're going to be saying we need to have a race, class, poverty audit. where is America since 1968, since Dr. King was assassinated, since the Poor People's March that was not completed? Where are we? Beyond just party, where are we? And what kinds of policies have continued to exacerbate poverty in this country? And what kinds of policies have been blocked? We need to have a serious audit, and we're putting together a team of economists and others to help do that and release it on April the 4th, 2017, the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. And then thirdly, we are calling for not a remembrance or a memorial, but a reenactment and a reengagement of the Poor People's Campaign in 2018. We stand to see 30 million people removed from health care if certain policies are passed. We stand to see 64 million people in this country still not have access to a basic living wage. That doesn't tell the whole story. It doesn't tell the story about all of the poverty, all of the people that don't even have health care, even with the Affordable Care Act. So we believe that we must engage with the poor and raise poverty and race as critical issues that we must demand be addressed regardless of who's in power. And we must bring all of our tools to this struggle, because I really believe, lastly, that we are right in the adolescent stages of a third reconstruction in this country, and the forces of extremism are trying to shut it down and to stop it from happening. But we have to stand up in this moment and declare that standing down is not an option.
You've raised the question of a third reconstruction of racial justice and healing in America. And I was thinking about that as you were speaking, also in conjunction with a presentation that I heard you make some time ago, and that was the Moral Foundation of Worker Rights, which What a pleasure to hear that. You have brought together the issue of economic justice, of race and class, which has been an enormous divide, even within certainly the liberal and left sectors of this country. And I wonder if you can talk more about that melding, that third reconstruction and coming together of the issues of race and class, and why it's imperative for us to proceed on both fronts.
Yes, simultaneously, and not try to find one that doesn't have to deal with the issue of race or be stuck just in the issue of race without dealing with the issue of class. It's so important. First of all, when you look at the first Reconstruction in the 1800s, 1868, 1890s, they developed something called fusion politics, where former slaves and former white poor farmers found alliances after the Civil War and came together. And in coming together, they passed some of the most progressive educational laws and even labor laws and criminal justice laws and voting laws in the South. In fact, most of the legislators by 1872 were either predominantly black or were a fusion coalition of blacks and whites that came together. It was powerful. Now, there was a resistance to it, because that kind of fusion was bringing major transformation in this country. Then you get to the Civil Rights Movement, which is, I call, the Second Reconstruction. Blacks and whites and Jews and Christians and others come together and form a major coalition around issues of justice and civil rights. People forget that the March on Washington was the march for jobs and freedom, not just for civil rights. This is 1963. Fusion comes together, but then you get a response called the Southern Strategy. And at the core of that strategy was, how do we talk about race and class in a way that's coded, but it divides people, the blacks from whites, and make many whites fear blacks and other people as their problem rather than seeing them as allies? And that's been the playbook that's been played by many Republicans and extremists. It's been the playbook that has not been unpacked well by Democrats and progressives. And so today, we got to have a grown-up conversation about race and class. For instance, during this past election that was more about insults and inflection than it was about injustice and poverty and civil rights. Think about it. We had all of these debates, not one major debate focused on voting rights and restoring the Voting Rights Act 50 years afterwards. We did not have a major debate around living wages. In fact, most of the time when race came up, it was either Donald Trump going to black communities, talking a white community, talking about the poverty in black community, or it was the Democrats talking about David Dukes and white supremacists, which is a form of racism.
but it doesn't get at the core issue, and this is the issue. If there are 8 million more poor white people than there are black people, and more poor whites that need social safety net programs, but yet in their top 10 out of the 12 poorest states are so-called red states, where many whites are voting for candidates who are opposed to the very social safety nets they need and living wage and health care, what is it that trumps common sense? That is the grown-up question. And then how do we go in with language and a methodology that brings whites and blacks together? And we think we have found a way. We are organizing now in North Carolina in the mountains. There's 99% white and 89% Republican. And in the eastern part of the state, that's predominantly black and predominantly Democrat, bringing people together to see their common realities and their common need for each other. Because if you can ever get blacks and whites and Latinos, particularly in the South and the Rust Belt, to see this common reality, to not be plagued by those who would divide us, you can fundamentally transform America. Because if you transform the South, you transform the country. That's the grown-up conversation and organizing that we must engage in the 21st century.
Reverend Barber, in 1968, when Dr. King was calling for this Poor People's March, he was also in Memphis helping to organize mm-hmm. a union of sanitation workers. What is the role of unions in this struggle at this point, especially now that Trump basically and his Labor Department nominee are totally anti-union in their policies?
Well, again, we can't be had. I've done a lot of speaking at our unions, and I know that Trump tried to say, elect me, and I'm going to protect your jobs, and I'm going to secure America, and I'm going to redo the trade deals. You guess who said that same thing in 1968? George Wallace. In New York, there's a speech that George Wallace did when he's running for president in Madison Square Garden that is almost a template for Trump speeches. And the problem is you can't trust somebody who will say that to you about jobs and about America first, but then on the other side of that, the policies that they're going to engage in that are racist at their core and classist driven at their core, and they're going to hurt the least of these. You got to listen to everything. So a person tells you, I'm going to save your jobs, but then supports voter suppression, is just lying. You can't separate the two. I've said to a lot of my union brothers and sisters, the fight for voting rights and the fight for labor rights are the same fight. If you do not have voting rights, if you're able to suppress the vote of black and brown and poor people, you will never elect progressive candidates that will be supportive of labor rights. We have to unpack the mythology that someone like Trump, and I don't just lay it at Trump, it's Trumpism. It's not just him. I mean, there are people that aren't as loud and as brash as him. Take, for instance, Speaker Ryan is anti-union. He's anti-living wages. He's anti-voting rights. Senate Leader McConnell, same thing. Both of them have held up fixing the Voting Rights Act for more than 1,200 days. So we have to really do an unpacking. Number two, Dr. King begged the unions and civil rights movement to come together and form what he called an organizing fund to put money in the South to stop giving up the South. If we're going to battle against Trumpism, then we have to work in the South and bring white, poor, working class people and black people together around the issues of race and economic, not just economic, but race and economic. And the reason is, if you can control the 13 former Confederate states from North Carolina through Georgia to Texas, you control 171 electoral votes, which means you only need 99 from the other 37 states. You control 26 members of the United States Senate, which means you only need 25 from the other 37 states. And you control 31% of the United States House of Representatives, which means you only need 20% from the other 37 states. You cannot give up that kind of power and walk away from it and allow the Southern strategy to win there and in the Rust Belt and not put up for a fight. One of the big things the union movement has to do is get behind a moral and civil rights movement and come South and begin to build these bridges.
I'm concerned, and you said it as well, it's not Trump as much as it is Trumpism, which for me is a shorthand to saying white supremacy, that largely created the situation for his ascendancy to the presidency, I believe. So how do you come up with a principled relationship and alliance between African American, Latino, and whites who continue to buy into the issues of white supremacy as they've done, which in part was what destroyed the second Reconstruction?
Exactly. A packaging of the white Southern strategy that Richard Nixon and Kevin Phillips put together, which was designed to do exactly what it's done over the last 45 or 50 years. You know, we started 3 years ago battling against extremism in North Carolina. That in the first 50 days, when the extremists took over the supermajority, they cut $1 billion from public education. They took 900,000 people's earned income tax credit, denied 180,000 people their unemployment, denied 500,000 people Medicaid expansion, which 346,000 were white, 30,000 veterans, and then passed the worst voter suppression law in the country. Some folks told us, well, there's nothing we can do. But we looked at history and said, wait a minute, every time there's been this kind of problem in history, there's been a moral response. So we said the first thing we have to do is go after the consciousness of the people, show them how they're connected together. We did. And we didn't win at first, but we decided to create a movement. I wrote a little book called Third Reconstruction, and we talk about 14 things that we learned during this process to engage. We decided to go into every part of North Carolina. You actually have to go where people are, and that people had real fears. Many people have played on economic and racial fears. So, for instance, we went to a place called Mitchell County. Mitchell County, 99% white, 89% Republican. And we met folk there, not as Democrat and Republican, but with the moral concern. And many of them would say things like, well, Obamacare is bad. And we say, well, okay, but let's look at this. Do you know that 1,000 people in this county would benefit from Medicaid expansion? And they can't be black because there are no black people up here. Do you know that when they cut 900,000 people's earned income tax credit, most of the people they cut were white in this county? We put a face on extremism. We want a significant group. And now we're organizing in those areas. Of the more than 1,200 people that got arrested, 60% of them were white. 11% of them were Republican. And we kept going, kept organizing. This year, after 3 years of it, in the election cycle, as you know, in North Carolina, Trump won slightly. But in North Carolina, the governor loses to a more progressive candidate. The AG loses. The secretary of state is won by a progressive. The attorney general is won by a progressive. And the Supreme Court, an African-American, wins 76 counties in North Carolina and wins by a margin of 350,000 votes in a place where they did not think that was possible. If you decide to build a movement and you work hard at it and you build allies and fusion and show people their connections and put race and poverty at the center of that movement, you can win. It might be, really, in the midst of all this badness, that Trumpism is going to do more to pull people together than they realize. Because, first of all, they can't deliver on what he's saying he's going to do. Number two, the policies are going to hurt people. But sometimes it's in the middle of hurt that people find a place to come together for healing. And this is not America's first time electing a racist president. We just have to own that. This is not the first time that a white man has used the tactics of the Southern strategy to fool and to divide people in the Rust Belt and in the South. Perhaps if we work hard enough and we believe hard enough, we can make it one of the last times that it ever happened.
And we'd love to keep you longer, and I hope we'll have another time to do that. I remember Professor John Henry Clark said, you know, we need an awful lot less charismatic leaders and much more charismatic movements. Well, we definitely need charismatic movements, but I find you an enormously charismatic leader. How do those of us who are listening to your voice now, what is the sense of the kind of organizing we need to do to carry some of the success and some of the hope and some of the philosophy that you have imparted to us in the last half hour into our work up north? Or up south, as some would call it.
Let me say four things. First of all, I want to encourage people to join my live stream if you're not in D.C. and our watch night service. Remember, it was 1862 when black people had watch night services and the abolitionists. Now, they didn't have watch night service because on January 1st, 1863, the fight was over. They did it because they were waiting for the clock to say 12:01 so they could join the fight. So the first thing I want to say, all of us have to have the attitude, we are going to join this fight. We may have been dejected on November the 9th, but if we were fighting for health care, voting rights, and labor rights on November 7th, we ought to be fighting for it November 9th and beyond, regardless of what happened November the 8th. That's number one. I want folks to join. You can go to repairersofthebreach.org, www.repairersofthebreach, and find out all the information. Number two, clergy are coming together. I just finished with some people a 22-state revival tour from April to November. I thought we were having a revival just for this year. It was called Revival Time for a Moral Revolution of Values. But everywhere we went, from Wisconsin to Kansas to Alabama, we found coalitions of people, black and white and Jews and Christians and Muslims, who are not giving up. And we have to begin to connect all of that, and that's the work that I'm engaged in. In fact, if you go again to our website, www.repairers.org, we have a higher ground moral agenda that we are pushing and promoting and organizing around. We're going to be doing a lot of work in key cities around the fight for 15. And I think that we have to build this moral movement. Third, I want folk, if they can, to join us in this poor people's campaign. You cannot simply debate a Trump or Trumpism just fight for fight, word for word. You have to create a movement, a moral movement. You have to go higher. But I don't mean higher by escaping the fight. You have to fight from higher ground if you're going to win. And the higher ground is our deepest moral and economic value. And we have to have a movement from the ground up. It's not going to come from D.C. down. It has to come from the ground up. And then lastly, I want to encourage people, if you're students of the scriptures or whatever faith tradition, read what your tradition has to say about struggle and fighting and battles. And if you're a student of history, go back and read the battles like Henry David Thoreau and others. And one piece, read this. Frederick Douglass's speech after the Dred Scott decision. The Dred Scott decision said a black man has no rights that a white man has to honor. It made it so that even if you escaped from slavery and went to New York, that slave master could send the slave patrol and get you. And people said it was the end of the abolitionist movement. Google that speech and see what Frederick Douglass said, not before the Dred Scott decision, but after the Dred Scott decision and his determination post the Dred Scott decision. And then grab that same determination post the Trump election and say that like they did then, now, we will not give up on the possibilities of this democracy. Not now, not ever. Let's work together.
Si se puede, and with those words that you have given us, you have helped us construct the moral foundation of workers' rights. You've helped us work towards building the third reconstruction of racial justice, and we're on board. And we have been speaking with the Reverend William Barber II, pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And we're going to speak a lot more to someone who speaks in the prophetic tradition of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and is doing such important work for all of us. Thank you so much for joining us.
God bless, and thank you both.
And thank you for helping us build some bridges.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
And that's really the theme of our program. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
We are the only minority group that you can join overnight.
From Overnight Productions.
In the twinkling of an eye, in fact.
1-5-0.
Welcome to the 1500th edition of This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell.
And I'm Greg Gordon. Our news wrap crew is off for the holidays. They'll catch us up on the stories in or affecting LGBT communities around the world in early January, including this week's breaking news out of North Carolina, where banana Republicans have rejected HB2 repeal.
This week, we commemorate TW World 1500 with recollections from some of the stalwart volunteer correspondents who have brought us this far.
This is Maggie Young and Katie Cook, and we are the Sapphic Nomads. 4 years ago, we set out on a year-long journey to learn about LGBTQ people around the world. Through social media and friends of friends, we were able to connect with people all over the globe, and in addition to doing interviews, we got to eat family meals with them, go to gay clubs with them, and even march on the streets with them. When people ask us what we learned on this journey, we often find ourselves talking about the various ways people felt they fit into a global LGBTQ movement. One interview we found particularly interesting was with Deepak Kashyap, a psychologist in Mumbai, India.
We don't have a culture of giving equal rights to people. Huh. You are an untouchable. You are the Shudras, and I am the Rajput, and I am the Brahmin, and I'm... So India's definition of equal is some people are more equal than others. This entire idea of equality is a Western import, and I would rather I import this.
Some people we interviewed also argued that the very labeling of LGBTQ is itself a Western idea. For example, in Samoa, there is the ancient tradition of what some refer to as a third gender identity. President of the Fa'afafine Association, Roger Stanley, explains.
Fa'afafine, or the type of people that we are, is very unique. It's a Samoan word. It derives from the word fafine, which is woman. Fa'a is become like a woman. Fa'afafine has always been here and always been around in Samoa during the pre-Christianity. We've been born biologically males, but we chose to become women because most of us feel that it's from inside, it's from the heart.
Setting off into our journey, we'd never imagined just how deep and rich the experience would be. And just as we've felt honored to meet and interview so many great people, we also have a profound gratitude for This Way Out and its vast and diverse network of listeners around the world. We'd like to congratulate This Way Out on their milestone 1500th show. From Denver, Colorado, this is Maggie Young and Katie Cook for This Way Out.
Hi, this is John Frame from Brisbane, Australia, congratulating This Way Out on the landmark 1500th program of world-class LGBT support and entertainment. I'm proud to have been a regular contributor for nearly two decades.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
One of my favourite shared interviews was with Rufus Wainwright in January 2005 in the lead-up to an Australian tour he did with his family, the McGarrigle family.
When I started my career, the first thing I said to my record company, even before I sat down at the table, I mean literally sat down, I said, I just want you to know, before we have this meeting, I am not pretending to be straight. I am going to be totally honest about my homosexuality. Because I was afraid that, you know, contractually they'd try to bind me into something. And then also, I mean, I have always really been excited by the history of gay culture and the real sort of tradition of high art and high standards, which you know, has existed for hundreds of years within gay culture. And I felt I was at a tremendous advantage because I could draw from that and you know, carry on that tradition. That has definitely fueled me and helped me.
For a song with a straightforward message, including the title, Gay Messiah, it does have the potential, I think, to offend people who want to be offended.
Yeah. That song's interesting to me because it's had three lives already. When I first wrote it, it was essentially a joke song. I mean, it was something to be sung at, you know, cocktail parties or, you know, to sort of liven up an audience and laugh a little. And then it became a bit of a protest song and, you know, was always followed by a plea, go out and vote in the next election, you know, because us gays are kind of in the line of fire here and are not appreciated by the majority of the Republican Party. And then after, of course, unfortunately, the election was lost, the song then became a literal prayer for an actual gay messiah and for some sort of divine intervention. And I do kind of consider it in that weird way, like I do consider it like an actual prayer.
Then pray for yourselves. Then pray for yourselves. Cause the game of science comes.
This is John Frame from Brisbane, Australia.
I'm Dixie Treichel, a host on Fresh Fruit. I and my co-host, John Townsend, have delighted in sharing some of our locally produced material with This Way Out. Kate Bornstein was on tour performing and doing readings from her new memoir, A Queer and Pleasant Danger. While in Minneapolis, she talked with me about her theater and writing development and how she incorporates gender theory into her work.
My original art was theater. Theater is where I first write my pieces. Theater is where I come up with the ideas, because theater, live performance art, that's the scariest thing. Getting up in front of people and ripping your heart out and saying scary stuff about yourself and saying, can I still be a decent human being? That has been the basis of all my writings.
The very first book you ever wrote.
People pushed me on it. I didn't want to write a book. Theater, you can change the ending at the last minute if you want to. You can realize, hey, this isn't going so well, and change it and make it better. Once it's a book, it's in stone. And I wasn't sure of anything.
Was that Gender Outlaw?
It was. After Gender Outlaw came out and was a hit, so Routledge asked me right away, would you write another one? Then it turned into a child workbook format, my gender workbook. It was still trans theory. There was more in there about the impact of race, age, class onto the idea of trans. So that was a transformation in my writing. I was looking out beyond trans as a single issue. And then I toured around and I was really getting tired of all the bullying I was seeing. That eventually became one chapter in the book, Hello, Cruel World. Mm-hmm. And so writing Hello, Cruel World was learning to write about the scariest stuff there is, death, your own, and doing it with love. So I was able to talk like from this elder point of view. For the first time, I called myself a crone in training while I was writing that book.
Kate Bornstein, in Minneapolis, this is Dixie Treichel for This Way Out.
I wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love.
This is Janet Mason. I've been writing and recording commentary for This Way Out for almost 2 decades. I've long been intrigued by the intimate nature of radio. I have memories of being shaped by the radio. Early in life as an adolescent, alone in my room in my parents' house, but connected to the world through the magic power of radio. When I first came out, I would listen to my local lesbian feminist radio show. Yes, I said lesbian feminist. It was that long ago. As a child, I discovered the world through books. It makes sense that I would want to keep those worlds alive by writing and recording commentary on literature, particularly literature that reflects queer life. A lot has changed, but some would say the more things change, the more they stay the same. Occupying queer space on the radio airwaves is important now as ever to the LGBT community. It has been my privilege to work with This Way Out to provide you with queer commentary over the years. Every now and then I hear from a listener, and always I am moved. Not only do I get to be part of an important LGBT vehicle for queer culture, but I get to be part of your world also. And being connected to the worldwide LGBTQ movement, I feel larger than myself. In the words of the great gay bard Walt Whitman, I am large, I contain multitudes. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
The history of the Rainbow Minute, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. On February 9, 2005, Richmond gay activist Judd Proctor just happened to tune in to the new community radio station WRIR. He was delighted to discover This Way Out, a gay and lesbian news magazine in Richmond of all places. He immediately called the station to offer his support. Judd and his partner Brian Burns decided to underwrite This Way Out and had the board operator read a 30-second blurb honoring a gay or lesbian icon in history. The first was about Harvey Milk, who stressed the importance of coming out. It was read live on the air by Dustin Richardson on February 16, 2005. Blurbs remembering architect Philip Johnson and lesbian activist Barbara Giddings followed. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Sally Holscruth.
Straight military personnel will have to shower with homosexual...
To accept the principle that homosexuals can't shower with other people is a degree of discrimination that goes far beyond this. I mean, we don't get ourselves dry cleaned.
Hello, I'm Barney Frank, and you are listening to This Way Out.
1-5-0-0 This Way Out program number 1500 continues.
In the port of Amsterdam, in the port of Amsterdam.
This is the first legal civil marriage between two men or two women, and that is unique in the world.
Today I finally get to look at the man that I love and say, will you please marry me?
Yes to inclusion, yes to generosity, yes to love, yes to equal marriage.
Marriage equality has been one of the signature LGBT issues during our 1500 show run. Listen to how we marched down the aisle from the Netherlands to the U.S. to Ireland to Canada with coverage like this.
How the world can change, it can change like that, due to one little word, married.
Hello, This Way Out listeners. It's Heather Kitching here. And back in 2005, I covered for This Way Out the Canadian House of Commons vote to legalize same-sex marriage. I covered this from a pub in the LGBT village in Vancouver, where I was living at the time, because that's where queers in Vancouver went to watch the vote on TV. Queers in most provinces of Canada had already won same-sex marriage through the courts by this point, so this whole thing kind of felt a bit anticlimactic. But then I thought, this is still a historic moment. This is our democratically elected government affirming that same-sex couples are equal to straight couples. So at the last minute, I went. And of course, I'm very glad I did, because this is one of those moments that has gone down in history.
The question is the following, where Mr. Cotton, seconded by Mr. Peterson, moved that Bill C-38, an act respecting certain aspects of legal capacity for marriage for civil purposes, be now read a third time and do pass. In favor of the motion, will please rise.
Monsieur Martin Lassalle.
The crowd cheered when our supporters stood up to cast their votes. They booed when our opponents voted against us. And then it happened.
Yes pour 158, 158, nays contre 133.
I'm Heather Kitching.
This is Brian Goebel, and I contributed features to This Way Out for many years. And one of my favorite interviews was with the playwright Tony Kushner, a writer I really admire and look up to. It actually took me a really long time to land the interview, but he finally agreed. And in 2008, I flew to New York City. It was my first time in New York. And I was a nervous wreck, but he was a very gracious host. He had a stack of books about Lincoln on his desk because he was writing a film for Steven Spielberg at the time. And it was an incredible interview, and as I was leaving, his last words to me were, "Enjoy the city," and boy, did I enjoy New York City.
Greetings, prophets! The great work begins! The messenger has arrived!
Tony Kushner's masterpiece, Angels in America, a gay fantasia on national themes, thrust him onto the international stage in the early 90s as one of the major playwrights of his generation. The seven-hour epic, in two parts, is a politically and emotionally fused portrait of gay life in the 80s under Ronald Reagan. It won Kushner a Pulitzer Prize and was made into a film directed by Mike Nichols in 2003.
If people like you didn't have President Reagan to demonize, where would you be?
If he didn't have people like me to demonize, where would he be?
I visited Kushner at his tiny Manhattan office.
Anything that's worth doing is hard to do. And I think that it seems to me, at any rate, that learning how to write a really good play is a lifetime's work. And, to do something well is great, but to do something better after that and to keep improving would seem to me to be the goal of the thing. You don't want to just have done it well once. You really would like to be, to have a career in a way like O'Neill's, where he, got better and better and better and better until he wrote his greatest play and the greatest play any American ever wrote at the end of his life. I would like to believe that at the end of my life I'll be able to say, well, I kept trying to figure out how to write plays and get better at them.
Tony Kushner, thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goebel in New York.
You are fabulous, each and every one. And I bless you. More life. The great work begins.
Who made This Way Out sing? Our queer music maestros take up the baton again in honor of their fallen friend. But first,
making it to This Way Out number 1500 would have been nearly impossible without the rock-solid journalism of the late Cindy Friedman, our news director for more than two decades.
Her skills as a news hound were without peer, But what we miss most about Cindy Friedman is her often wicked sense of humor. Here's an example from February 1999 with Cindy and co-anchor Leo Garcia.
Winky, winky, tinky, winky, 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 tinky, winky.
The most widely reported gay story in U.S. media this week was the outing of the star of an international television show, which has spun off a marketing empire of best-selling videos, audio recordings, and other items. Former leader of the now-defunct Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell, has published in his National Liberty Journal this parent alert.
The sexual preference of Tinky Winky, the largest of the four Teletubbies characters on the series that airs in America on PBS stations, has been the subject of debate since the series premiered in England in 1997. The character, whose voice is obviously that of a boy, has been found carrying a purse in many episodes.
Teletubbies producers insist that the so-called purse is in fact a magic bag. Here to speak for himself is...
Tinky Winky!
Mr. Winky, would you care to comment?
Now, further evidence that the creators of the series intend for Tinky Winky to be a gay role model have surfaced. He is purple, the gay pride color, and his antenna is shaped like a triangle, the gay pride symbol.
In our reviews of some 40 mainstream press reports and columns, Falwell has been universally ridiculed. Falwell has been universally ridiculed. After 2 days of media assault, Falwell told NBC that he didn't really mean that you are gay, but that if you are, he is concerned. There are also those who maintain that, as a Teletubby, you are only vaguely human and cannot be considered to have gender attributes at all, much less a sexual orientation. Mr. Winky, I must ask you the question that has so obsessed America this week. Are you gay?
Big hug.
Bye. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman with Leo Garcia.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way.
Welcome back to the Audiophile 2010 Year in Review. I'm Pam Marshall.
I'm Christopher David Trentum.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle.
That's from the final edition of the 14-year run of Audiophile on This Way Out in December of 2010. Our monthly queer music segment brought dozens of fabulously talented outperformers to the attention of This Way Out listeners worldwide.
We asked audiophilers J.D. Doyle in Houston and Chris Wilson and Pam Marshall in Los Angeles to reflect on their longtime collaboration. They each also wanted to pay tribute to a beloved colleague and This Way Out benefactor.
What few of the listeners realized, and what made working on Audiophile both interesting and challenging, is that, no, we did not record the show at the same time or even in the same studio.
Everything became possible with a traveling laptop and sound equipment. But how did we create the proper acoustic in-studio environment at home? For the better part of our 14 years on the air, Audiophile was, in fact, recorded in the closet.
It still kind of amazes me.
By the way, all of our shows are still available on the internet at audiophile.org. Just click on Audiophile Archives, which is maintained with a searchable index by J.D. Doyle.
The producers of This Way Out asked Chris and I to each pick a favorite artist segment out of those we did. Well, that's a little like picking among your children, as over the 14-year period, we featured 424 different recordings by 325 different artists. But we did each manage to come up with just one.
Each of these artists was featured three times during the Audiophile run, so yes, we really like them. They are Janice Ian and Levi Kreiss. Janice, of course, has been an important artist since the 1960s, and Levi won a Tony Award in 2010 for the musical Million Dollar Quartet. These segments originally ran in 2004 and 2006.
I am standing on the bones of a mountain to hide a crime.
You know, artists, when we're doing our job, we get to take people's dreams
and make something visible out of them. And then when people forget that they have dreams and everything looks really dark and horrible, we get to remind you that they exist. And that's a serious privilege for us, you know. I feel like I stand on a lot of people's bones every time I get up on stage. And the bones of people like Billie Holiday who do that for me and continue to do it for me.
Somehow I feel I should apologize, 'cause I'm just a little shaken, but what's going on inside?
The second album by Levi Christ is called One of the Ones.
It's a collection of songs about relationships that I've been in with various guys that I've crushed on or dated or loved with all my heart. I chose to keep it very intimate, the piano and the vocals, and hoping that the human experience that I've gone through is kind of relatable for everyone.
Lovely.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall, remembering Christopher David Trentum.
Or as we always called him, CDT.
He taught us to edit audio tape with a razor blade and keen listening skills.
He engineered many, many radio features for us, including Audiophile, eventually moving us into the 21st century with digital editing and production.
This is J.D. Doyle, and paying tribute to CDT is especially important to me. When I was invited to join Audiophile, I was fairly new at my own radio show, and what he taught me about the engineering and production part of it was invaluable and jump-started my own work. He was a picky perfectionist, and I'm sure right now he would be fussing at me for popping my peas. At times, he could be exasperating, but somehow was always right, and I am the better for knowing him.
But beyond that, he became part of our extended family, joining us for the holidays.
As well as for Pam's home-cooked meals following each Audiophile recording session.
CDT was one of the most genuinely decent people I have ever known.
And although you rarely heard him on the air, Audiophile's 14-year run would not have been possible without him.
We miss him.
We certainly do. We keep up a tribute page at ChristopherDavidTrentum.com, where you can find out more about our good friend and co-producer, who love trains, and This Way Out. And that's it for the final edition of Audiophile. We would like to thank the literally hundreds of GLBT musicians for sharing their music with us for the past 14 years.
And special thanks to Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle for providing us the opportunity to present Audiophile here on This Way Out.
And of course, we would very much like to thank you, our listeners, for supporting us over the years.
I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Christopher David Trentum.
Thank you for listening.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
There have been many generous funders of This Way Out who have helped us reach our 1500th program, including the Clarissa Pincola Estes La Sociedad de Guadalupe Foundation, the Gill Foundation, the Paul Rappaport Foundation,
Dr. Robert G. Simmons Jr., the Gay Chemist Support Fund, the Schwab Charitable Fund, and most recently the Yavanna Foundation, the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and the estate of Audiophile producer Christopher David Trentum.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. Sapphic Nomads, Maggie Young and Katie Cook, John Frame, Dixie Trichel, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Sally Hosgreave, Heather Kitching, Brian Goebel, and Chris Wilson, Pam Marshall, and J.D. Doyle helped us celebrate our 1500th program.
Rufus Wainwright, Jacques Brel, Alan Cumming, the Tom Robinson Band, Janice Ian, Levi Christ, and Sly and the Family Stone performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed or performed our theme music.
This Way Out is sustained through the generosity of our individual listener supporters.
We invite you to join them. Visit thiswayout.org to carry the TWO 1500 party right up through New Year's.
Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappell. Happy holidays from the entire This Way Out family.
We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org.
Across Europe, Africa, the Middle East, and the Asia-Pacific region on the World Radio Network.
And on more than 200 local stations around the world.
Including this community radio station.
Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So what did we do? What did we investigate and critique and present on this program in 2016? It's, of course, impossible to encapsulate, but what I like to do every 12 months is to go through the interviews I've done, come up with a list of favorites, and then present highlighted portions of those conversations. We've got what I think is a stellar lineup for you today, beginning with the sociologist Eric Olin Wright talking about unconditional basic income. Then you'll hear the political theorist Juliette Hooker discuss African-American protest politics and what it's fair to expect from those condemned to be perpetual losers in U.S.-style democracy. The political scientist Emanuele Saccardelli discusses how key radical thinkers viewed and interpreted the French Revolution and the European revolutions of 1848 and 1849. And we conclude with remarks by author and researcher Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt on cultural policy in Cuba under the late Fidel Castro. We begin with Eric Olin Wright, sociology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author of many books, including Understanding Class, Envisioning Real Utopias, and Alternatives to Capitalism. Eric told me that an unconditional basic income would be paid by the government to each citizen or resident of a nation without means testing or a work requirement.
The idea of unconditional basic income comes in a variety of flavors. And depending upon which flavor, it means different things. For some people, an unconditional basic income is really a bare minimum survival income. You know, to use it a kind of metaphor, you don't starve if you have a basic income. Most progressives who embrace the idea think of it as a more generous idea, that a true unconditional basic income enables you to live at a culturally acceptable, decent standard of living, which would include, therefore, enough income to have recreation, but a kind of no-frills version. So you can perfectly comfortably get by with it, but if you really want to live a more extravagant lifestyle, then you have to earn additional income one way or another. So that's how I like to think of it. Certainly for the purposes that I defend an unconditional basic income, it's above a survival level.
So what impact would an unconditional basic income have on people's ability and inclination, really, to take a job, to go into the labor market and work for money?
Yeah, so a basic income is an unworkable plan if it's the case that the large majority of people really have as their deepest longings to be couch potatoes. So, you know, if the human spirit, contrary to what many of us believe, is really profoundly lazy in the sense that we don't care about creativity, we don't care about making a contribution to our world and leaving our stamp with our in some way or other, we really just want to watch soap operas, right? So if that is what we are at our essence, you give people $15,000, everybody stops working, the system collapses. Well, I'm being sarcastic, you know.
Sure,
but
sure.
This is a caricature. There will be some people, though, that will absolutely, you know, live a life of leisurely indulgence. Philippe von Paris, is one of his earliest and terrific pieces on this, is called Should Surfers Be Fed? Should Surfers Be Fed? And it's basically raising the standard big objection to basic income, that it will mean that people who work hard and generate the income that gets taxed by the basic income will be subsidizing beach bums.
But you could certainly, maybe with a basic income, you could be a beach bum, but you could also be productive in a way that's not profitable to you, right? That doesn't involve working for money. So, for example, you talk about, you've written about caregiving labor, and the fact is that many caregivers are not compensated at all. Well, this will allow them to do work, that kind of work. They won't have a job for money, for pay. And so how does that work in the context of basic income? And to what extent is that a positive thing in your eyes?
Of course, it's an absolutely positive thing. There's a huge amount of socially productive labor that contributes to human flourishing, both of the person performing the labor and to other people in their lives. So there's lots of activities of that sort which would expand under an unconditional basic income. It gives people, in a sense, the possibility of saying no to capitalist employment and saying yes to all the other socially productive, interesting things, constructive things people can do. So caregiving would be one sort of obvious example, both for elder care and for children and disabled care. But so would the arts. An unconditional basic income might increase the number of bad poets in the society because it would enable more people to say, I want to try to be a poet, and not all of them will be good poets, so to speak. But it enables people to engage in the arts in a way that they can't if they have to be preoccupied with earning a living.
So essentially what you're saying is that workers have more power, they have greater leverage in relation to employers under a system with unconditional basic income. And is that part of the reason, well, how big a part of the reason that you support unconditional basic income is this, that there are unequal power relations in capitalist society and that a goal, an important goal of a movement for social justice ought to be to adjust and transform those power relations?
Yes, certainly. That, if you really play out the logic, that's probably the most fundamental issue for me, is its effect on power relations. But I think one needs to think of it in the following more, perhaps slightly more nuanced way. One can think of the redress of the imbalance of power of capitalism either in terms of the collective power of workers via their organization. That's classically how we do it. We argue workers are individually weak, but collectively they can be quite strong. And labor unions have been the principal form of such collective power of workers. And in sometimes in places, political parties that are either explicitly linked to the labor movement or at least implicitly linked to the labor movement, collective power. Unconditional basic income has a particularly strong effect on the individual power of workers. That is their ability to say no, which is a individual ability. You can walk away from a deal. That gives you power. It increases, therefore, their individual autonomy and capacity to do things. That has a second-order effect on their collective capacity. But it still has a potential positive effect on their collective capacity. It could conceivably weaken their collective capacity because they don't care about it as much. You know, if individuals can say no, why do we need a union? Unions have traditionally been very hostile to unconditional basic income. It's not part of the traditional union view. What unions want is to strengthen their negotiating power with employers in order to get a better wage bargain, among other things, with capitalist employers.
Is there a scenario in which you see unconditional basic income actually improving or augmenting the strength of unions?
Well, it could if there are grounds for solidarity that can be sustained, because you can think of unconditional basic income as an unconditional strike fund, too. It means workers could collectively refuse to work because they want improved working conditions or whatever, and the union doesn't have to have a strike fund because every worker has an unconditional basic income. Well, an unconditional basic strike fund is certainly something which would increase the negotiating power of unions, but only if workers also joined and voted for and backed unions. And I think on that score, it's ambiguous. I wouldn't want to sell basic income to unions on the grounds, look, support this because it's going to increase the power of unions. It might, but it could, in fact, undercut the power of unions.
Well, yeah, let's talk about political activity and the potential for progressive or radical political activity in a nation that has unconditional basic income. So what impact do you think such an income might have on, you know, political activity, community organizing, social movements?
So the most obvious effect would be to provide a massive basic political income, you know, activism income. It means that people can be community activists in all sorts of ways without having to, apply to nonprofits, to foundations, to find activist groups that happen to have angel donors. You know, they basically have an unconditional basic income that would support community activism. What I think one can say with kind of a simple, straightforward prediction is that locally oriented problem-solving activism in a grassroots sense, that would increase. Some of that will have quite progressive characters, but it would also mean that people involved in faith-based, church-oriented good works would increase. So exactly how that plays out politically, I think, is another ambiguity. So that's for sure. Now, whether it also contributes to a more coherent progressive politics, not just local activism doing good stuff, that, I think, doesn't follow one way or another from basic income.
I want to return to something you said earlier. So if increasing the collective power of labor versus capital is one of your primary goals, and if you're not sure whether the collective strength, not the individual strength, but the collective strength of workers will be augmented by an unconditional basic income, because, you know, workers might have higher individual leverage over employers, but not necessarily want to join unions or strengthen unions, then I'm not sure what accounts for your support, your continued support for the income.
The reason I strongly support rules of the game that increase the collective power of labor is because it's part of a bigger package of wanting to transform capitalism, and in particular wanting to transform capitalism in a way that points beyond capitalism. The rhetoric I use these days when I talk about this is that if you're opposed to capitalism, there's a variety of strategic visions you can have. You can have a vision of smashing capitalism. That's the ruptural revolutionary tradition. You can have a vision of taming capitalism. That's the social democratic idea of neutralizing its harms. You can have a vision of escaping capitalism, the sort of hippie in the woods solution. Or you can have a vision of eroding capitalism by building alternatives in the spaces where that's possible, and then engaged in struggles to expand those spaces. Build the future you want in the places where you can in the present and expand them through struggle. Now, the eroding capitalism requires changes in the rules of the game as well. Unconditional basic income is attractive because it's a change in the rules of the game about how people gain access to livelihood. It's a different kind of capitalism with an unconditional basic income than without it. But it unleashes the potential for people to engage in the process of building other kinds of economic systems inside of capitalism. They have the freedom to build a different world in the present. It would increase what's often called the social and solidarity economy. It would increase all sorts of cooperative enterprises. So in the long term, if we want to ask, what would it take to move beyond capitalism, if you don't think that a revolutionary rupture is any longer a plausible scenario, then eroding capitalism is the only prospect for its fundamental transformation. And basic income underwrites that dynamic, potentially. But like everything, I think, it has this contradictory quality. And thus, it would become a crucial problem to be solved. How can we reconstruct the collective agency of people to act politically? It becomes less important for them to act against employers at the point of production. That ceases to be the main site at which struggle is needed. But the struggle in the society over the rules of the game, over the state, is every bit as important, if only to defend the basic income and to make it a generous as opposed to a miserable one. You know, that requires collective action. And that is a problem. That is a problem. And it's a problem for which I don't have any magic wand solutions. But I think a capitalism with a generous basic income is a better terrain upon which to work on that problem than the capitalism we have today. Let me just add one thing here. in terms of the rhetoric around unconditional basic income. There are a variety of different defenses of it, reasons why people say, ooh, that's a great idea. Philippe von Paris, who I consider the deepest thinker about the philosophical foundations for a basic income, his position is what one might call a left libertarian position. It's or an egalitarian liberal position. What he argues is that unconditional basic income takes really seriously the value of freedom, which most people in Western democratic capitalist societies believe is a good thing, freedom, individual freedom. But it says the only way that we can have real freedom for all is if everybody has a basic income. So it's an egalitarian distribution of resources in order to create an egalitarian distribution of freedom. It really just says for freedom to be meaningful, you have to be able to make choices. And above all, you have to be able to say no to things that are harmful to you. And that's what an unconditional basic income does. It enables people to say no to bad employment. It enables people to say no to bad marriages. Women in particular, under the current conditions, the capacity to exit a marriage increases by virtue of the guarantee of the resources independently of any obligations. So Real Freedom for All, that's the title of his famous book on the topic, I think is the foundational justification, and that also justifies its unconditionality.
That was Eric Olin Wright, Vilas Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author of many books on capitalism, class, inequality, and radical theory. We've put a link to his website on againstthegrain.org. Just click on the title of today's program, which is called A Look Back. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We turn now to selected portions of an interview I did with Juliet Hooker about the politics of black protest in this country. Juliet Hooker is Associate Professor of Government and of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She spoke with me about what became a paper entitled Black Lives Matter and the Paradoxes of U.S. Black Politics, From Democratic Sacrifice to Democratic Repair. I'd like to ask you about what the political theorist Danielle Allen has written about the role of loss in democratic politics.
So one of the very insightful ideas that Allen explores is this notion that democracies are, or the experience of democracy, of being a citizen in a democracy, is defined by loss. And this is because citizens have different policy preferences. And inevitably, in a democracy where the majority, right, wins in any kind of policy debates, that means that there are winners and losers. That means that there's some people whose preferences get enacted and others who don't. And so while we think that democracy is about right participation and getting your agenda enacted, it's also about having the opposite happen, right? About not seeing that happen. So that she argues that, right, this experience of loss, of having to cope with losing an argument, is something that all citizens experience, and that therefore democracies have to find ways to cope with the experience of loss.
Cope with the experience of loss. And what happens in Allen's mind when some parts of a society lose more? They lose systematically. There is a disproportionate balance between winners and losers.
So one of the things that she points to the 1960s, and she argues that up until that point in the United States, what you had was that losses weren't equally distributed, right? That one group, you know, essentially got the task of winning and another got the task of being good losers. And the good losers were African Americans who weren't allowed to participate in politics, who were barred from equal employment opportunities, et cetera, who were operating under Jim Crow racial segregation. So one of the things that is key then to this idea of loss is that in a democracy, it's supposed to be arbitrarily distributed, right? There shouldn't be one systematic group that is always the one that loses a debate, that loses in terms of a policy decision. Because the experience then of having to sacrifice, right, to have to peacefully accept that you lost is one that all groups need to experience in order for it to be legitimate. Otherwise, what you have is like an uneven democracy where certain groups are always expected to be the ones who peacefully accept their losses and who sacrifice by peacefully accepting rather than revolting. And I think one of the things that I talk about in the paper is that I don't think that this stopped happening in the 1960s. I think we continue to have a pattern by which Blacks or African Americans are Democratic losers, are the ones who are expected to cope with and to make sacrifices on behalf of U.S. democracy.
We then talked about the civil rights protests of the 1960s, how the protesters are thought of today, and what misconceptions still circulate about the impact the protesters had on white observers.
This narrative, right, about these sort of middle class, respectable, well-behaved, nonviolent, heroic Black protesters who put themselves and their bodies on the line in order to achieve greater racial justice, then one of the things that it does is suggest that the way that there is one legitimate form that Black politics should take, right? And it's that form. And it's this form in which Blacks peacefully acquiesce to their losses. And when they protest, right, when they try to bring about change in racist structures, that they need to do so in a nonviolent way that is acceptable, that adheres to the norms of civility, that doesn't sort of offend white sensibilities, that they're not allowed to express, for example, rage, which is in some ways a very normal response to violence and to terror and to injustice, right? There's something absolutely normal and healthy about being angry at injustice. But that sort of range of human emotion is precluded by this mythical idea that what Black citizens should do is be these kind of superhuman figures who acquiesce peacefully, who put their bodies on the line, who enact this form of political heroism, and who in so doing are sacrificing themselves on behalf of the common good, right? Because what they're achieving is this greater good of more racially egalitarian society. But I think one of the things that I think is important to think about is whether, in fact, that shifts attention away from the kind of disparities and injustices that prompt Black protests in the first place, and on to this question of, well, how do we preserve peaceful, stable democracy rather than how do we address the injustices that cause people to protest in the first place?
Well, if, as you seem to be suggesting, African Americans are expected to be, in a sense, good losers by practicing the politics of respectability and nonviolence and to some degree acquiescence, although, you know, as you've said, nonviolent protest does not equal acquiescence, then it is instructive to look at whether whites in U.S. society have been good losers, have been the kind of losers that they expect, in your opinion, Blacks to be. And you go back to the 1960s when, you know, at least some of the privileges, the racial privileges of whites were undermined or eliminated. You go back and look at whether whites could or should be considered good losers at that time. What do you conclude?
So I conclude that they were not good losers. They have not been good losers. And the basis for this actually is a very discernible pattern in U.S. politics, where moments of you know, victories for greater racial equality have been followed by these periods of backlash and retrenchment where rights that have been gained have slowly been eroded. If you, right, we see this with the Civil War, right, which leads to the end of slavery and is followed by Reconstruction and the attempt to enfranchise African American men, which is then followed by the post-Reconstruction period of disenfranchisement, the, you know, establishing of racial segregation and Jim Crow and of, you know, sort of white supremacy as a, you know, official ideology of the country. And if you look at the 1960s, I think what we see is a similar pattern, right? The victories of the civil rights movement, which were, you know, of course, quite important and made enormous changes to U.S. society, were followed by, I think, a period where they were slowly, some of those gains have slowly been eroded. If you look at today, the dismantling of things like the Voting Rights Act or the placing barriers to minority voter registration, things of that sort, I think we see that some of the policies that were put in place in the 60s are being dismantled and were followed by this period, I think, of racial resentment.
Well, when African-American protests, recent ones, have moved in a kind of non-respectable, uncivil direction, they are often characterized as riots. And I think sympathizers of these African-American protesters would maybe call them uprisings. So, you know, on a concrete level, what is your sense of whether riots or uprisings or whatever you want to call them, whether they can be productive and whether they ought to be pursued if, you know, considered appropriate by the people at these events?
What I want to suggest is that we need to stop and think about, you know, what is it legitimate to ask people whose lives have been defined by mass incarceration, by state policy that has confine them in many cases by design to urban ghettos that don't have the same kind of state services or educational opportunities that are defined by, you know, sometimes predatory local governments that use fines and traffic tickets and other means to fund themselves via, you know, sort of these forms of taxation of those who are already poor. What is it legitimate for us as a democracy to ask those citizens to sacrifice, right, who are already sacrificing? Is it legitimate to ask them then to express their anger at injustice in these ways that we see as more productive or more, you know, more civil? So I think I would switch that question around to say, you know, what can we ask of them when they are already sacrificing? And I think what I want to suggest is that when we look at these moments when violent confrontations have erupted that, you know, that have been described as riots, one of the things that I suggest in the paper is that maybe we should consider whether that these, you know, riots are a form of democratic repair. And what I mean by that is that they are not constructive in the sense of they are not necessarily going to solve the sort of structural problems that lead to, you know, mass incarceration or, you know, police violence in the first place, but that they are maybe productive in the sense that they allow Blacks and the communities that are being affected by these problems to express their anger at these injustices, to make them visible in a way that they're otherwise not allowed, because this is beyond the norms of you know, sort of acceptable democratic politics.
That's the voice of Juliet Hooker, a political theorist based at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Race and the Politics of Solidarity and Theorizing Race in the Americas, forthcoming from Oxford University Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And today I'm presenting a set of year-end highlights, portions of interviews I conducted in 2016 that I found particularly thoughtful and astute. Next, we turn to Emanuele Saccadelli. He's a professor of political science at San Diego State University. He's the author of Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism, and he's co-author of Imperialism, Past and Present. I spoke with Emanuele earlier this year about an essay he contributed to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. His essay was about permanent revolution, and I asked Emanuele Saccadelli what Marx and Engels meant by that term.
This concept is a very significant political concept. When they originally used it, it wasn't really a concept so much as a historical allusion when they were talking in particular about the nature of the great French Revolution. And they used this term of permanent revolution to refer to the fact that starting in 1789, the revolutionary process had a series of very interesting and sharp twists and turns. For a time, it kept going more and more to the left, and it began simply as a rejection of the monarchy, or at least a rejection of the latest demands on the part of the monarchy by the Third Estate, and then it developed more and more radically and in a revolutionary manner down to the Jacobins and their government in 1793, 1794. So this was permanent revolution attempted to capture this idea that within the same set of events, there were multiple revolutionary surges and dynamics. Then, after the actual historical experience of 1848-49, there were a series of revolutions throughout continental Europe, Marx and Engels began to really use the same term in a different way. Suddenly, it became an actual political concept. And what they meant generally was that although much of the world still required what they called a bourgeois democratic revolution, because the old hierarchies and state forms of old, the characteristic of feudalism and absolutism, were still around. And the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, was supposed to go through this script of the great French Revolution and overthrow all those archaic political forms and replace them with modern, let's say, liberal and democratic forms, parliaments, constitutions, etc. Marx and Engels began to notice that the capitalist class became more and more hesitant, reluctant, and then actively hostile to that prospect. And therefore, that meant that even the basic bourgeois democratic rights of liberalism and constitutionalism, that began to fall more on the backs of the modern working class. That even though the working class was or should have been oriented towards socialism well beyond the somewhat narrow parameters of bourgeois democracy, the working class had to sort of be the protagonist for this entire process, from breaking down what was left of feudalism and absolutism through the experience of modern sort of bourgeois state all the way through socialism. So permanent revolution was a sort of compression of historical stages that before the experience of the mid-19th century were regarded as really distinct. First, a kind of a decades of bourgeois democracy, and then eventually the fight for socialism. Permanent revolution meant that that process would be combined and compressed.
So you were talking about what Marx and Engels observed, what they noticed about what was happening in 1848, 1849, throughout Europe, all these revolutions and upheavals. What had they said in the Communist Manifesto about the degree to which the proletariat, the working class, would need to depend on the capitalist class, would need to work in some senses with the bourgeoisie in order to achieve their ultimate goals?
Yes, what they said in the manifesto was somewhat let's say, provisional, and it had a political line, but I think it's also clear in reading the document that one would have to test it on the grounds of what would actually happen in the course of the revolutionary process. The general line seems to be that the working class basically for a time would have to fight not its enemy, the capitalist class, but the enemy of its enemy. That is to say, these remnants of feudalism, absolutism, monarchies, the aristocracy, all these archaic forces. And then and to fight against those side by side with the bourgeoisie, having vanquished those forces, then the real struggle for socialism could take place on a higher historical plane of bourgeois democracy against constitutions, liberalism, rights, etc. However, they also very clearly make the point that even though this class alliance would be necessary, there are certain important qualifications in the manifesto. One of them is that they insisted that we should fight with the capitalist class whenever it acts in a progressive and revolutionary manner, suggesting that when it doesn't, then we shouldn't go in that direction.
Could you talk more, Emanuele, about how the bourgeoisies in Europe, how they conducted themselves during the revolution, the revolutions of 1848-49, such that Marx and Engels and many radical thinkers and revolutionaries lost faith in the bourgeoisie and its ability to provide a kind of spur to the eventual working class revolution?
Yes. As I said earlier, apparently the template was there. The bourgeoisie was simply meant to kind of carry out the same general script as had taken place in 1789 France. That is to say, a fight in a very revolutionary and principled manner against monarchy, and let's say what was left of feudalism, aristocracy, etc. What happened in 1848-49 throughout Europe was of a very different character. First of all, it was not the capitalist class that really initiated this wave of revolutionary movements. It was actually popular layers, workers, or what Marx called the petit bourgeoisie. Wealthy people were not initiating these revolutionary processes, and once they began, they very quickly took a somewhat equivocal position. Their basic political thinking went something like this. They would have much preferred to have bourgeois democracy over various forms of monarchical political rule. But they were also very concerned that, unlike in 1789 in France, by 1848-49 there was in fact a modern working class. The process of industrialization is typically dated to be complete around that time. There were large factories and the modern proletariat existed. In the face of that reality, the bourgeoisie began to get cold feet when it came to these revolutionary struggles, because they simply could not be certain that they could control fully the revolutionary process. They could perhaps control where it began, but they had no assurances that they could control where it would end. And texts like the Communist Manifesto already, in a sense, put them on notice that if the feudal order and the monarchies were to fall, next on the agenda would be them. And so these people, of course, were not stupid. They understood that there was a countervailing factor now in the world of politics. Their revolutionary enthusiasm of 1789 was dampened by the presence of the working class. And Marx has other texts in which he brilliantly exposes their cowardly behavior, their hesitations, their timid orientation toward the monarchy, and ultimately really that they actually cut a political deal with the old order, preferring that to rolling the dice on a revolutionary process that, as I said earlier, may not end too well for them. And so all of these revolutionary events that swept the great cities of Europe, Rome, I'm from Rome, the Pope, fell and was replaced briefly by a republic, Vienna, Berlin, Paris, of course. All of these cities went through an actual revolutionary uprising in which the workers played a leading role, in which the bourgeoisie reluctantly participated and then pulled back And the case of Paris is perhaps the most instructive case because there's a revolution in February 1848, then there's a second revolution in June, and the bourgeoisie intervenes in that second revolution very directly to basically wipe out the workers from their barricades. So they literally are on the other side of the barricades. People like Alexis de Tocqueville, for example, who represented them, are fighting on the other side of the barricades, and they would eventually feel far more comfortable with an accommodation with the monarchy than with the processes they were witnessing throughout Europe.
Later in the conversation, Emanuele Saccarelli took up the question of what Karl Kautsky, the Czech-Austrian theoretician and journalist, and for a time a prominent radical thinker, what Kautsky said and observed about the political situation in Europe.
So in looking at Germany, but also in looking at Russia, he noticed, rightly, that capitalism had been around for decades, and very modern industry had been installed, certainly in Germany, but also more and more in Russia as well, and yet the political superstructure in this country was not changing. Certainly, Germany didn't have a proper liberal democracy. It had a very curious parliamentary system with a Kaiser on top of that. And, of course, Russia had a Tsar, the most archaic and really quite awful of all of these political forms. And so why was that the case? And Kautsky begins to think that the German and the Russian bourgeoisie may not have particular interest in overthrowing those types of institutions and establishing a proper bourgeois democracy. And he sees this very clearly in the, again, in the actual political behavior of these people. If you think about Russia, I mean, an extremely wealthy capitalist in Russia would look at the Tsar and say, well, of course, I don't particularly enjoy the absence of freedom of the press and freedom of assembly. Perhaps that person would be at some level still inspired by the great slogans of the French Revolution. But the reality is that the Tsar is a very useful political instrument, because when the workers go on strike, and in Russia they would more and more and more militantly, the Tsar has some nice features, very attractive features, secret police to infiltrate the workers' movement, a massive body of armed men to crush them in the streets when that's necessary. And so from the standpoint of the bourgeoisie, these archaic forms are actually more and more regarded as not just a wart on the body politic, but more and more as a real necessity. And by the way, this is true to this day. I don't think these are just issues of historical significance. When one looks, for example, at countries like in the Middle East, like Egypt or Saudi Arabia, and one thinks about, well, those are definitely capitalist countries. And yet the political superstructure is quite archaic. Why is that? Well, it's because of the reasons that Kautsky began to formulate.
And that was Emanuele Saccarelli, a political scientist based at San Diego State University. You can read his essay, The Permanent Revolution in and Around the Manifesto, in the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto, edited by Terrell Carver and James Farr. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song, and we round out today's 2016 highlights program with some remarks about what Fidel Castro was able to accomplish in Cuba on the cultural front. Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt is the founder of and a researcher at the Center for Cultural Change in the UK, and I had her on to talk about her book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. I asked Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt whether Fidel Castro and his comrades considered themselves Marxists or communists when they took power in 1959.
No, the revolution wasn't fought on a Marxist platform. It was a movement of national liberation to regain the national sovereignty from the neo-colonial relationship that existed between the United States and Cuba, which had been preceded by centuries of colonial rule by the Spanish. So Cuba hadn't, in fact, enjoyed its own national sovereignty for quite some time. And that was really the platform on which the revolution was fought. But there were those within the leadership who had an understanding of Marxism, who'd read the key texts of Marxism, and that sort of emphasis began to find its way into the revolutionary milieu in the immediate aftermath of the triumph of the revolution. But having said that, the actual explicit nature of the program wasn't made clear until spring 1961. So that's when the government started to become much more explicit that the program was actually socialist, although those who'd been observing it before were able to see that it was clearly socialist in its orientation. But it was actually a final act of aggression on the part of the United States that drove Cuba into the socialist and Soviet ambit.
And that was the Bay of Pigs.
Indeed, yeah.
So what did Fidel Castro say about the importance and relevance of culture and art to the revolution?
Well, Fidel himself was more interested in sport, but he understood from his comrades that culture was an integral part of the new society that they were trying to build. So when it came to actually dealing with culture, he delegated it to those who knew better than he did in that field. But at the same time, he firmly embraced the idea that culture was central to the society that they were building. He talked about returning art to the people. When we think about the pre-revolutionary era, which was very elitist, there was a very clear and conscious decision taken to disband that kind of elitist mentality, to break down the barriers between the urban and rural areas, to bring literacy to the people, to bring culture to the people. That formed very clearly a part of their early program.
Give us some details about the literacy campaign that Castro and his comrades instituted soon after they took power.
Well, in the immediate aftermath of the revolution, so as soon as the revolution had triumphed, Che Guevara was actually instrumental in teaching all the comrades who'd fought alongside him to read. And then slowly, slowly, that program was extended. And in 1961, Fidel Castro gave a speech at the United Nations saying that within a year they would eradicate all illiteracy on the island. And the way in which they did that was that they called for volunteers. 250,000 people came forward, around 100,000 of whom were young people, teenagers, many of whom were women. And they went out into the countryside and taught the peasant population to read, in a sensational program that means that Cuba has the highest literacy rate in the world today, either the first or second highest in the world today.
And this literacy campaign, I mean, to what extent has it been identified as embodying or symbolizing the kind of energy that the revolution both contained and unleashed?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are important to mention. One is that young people who had been too young to play a part in the Revolutionary War suddenly had a role within revolutionary society, which was fantastically important in terms of giving them a place within society, making them feel involved, and changing their consciousness. There's a fantastic film that's just came out a while ago by Catherine Murphy. It's called Maestra. And she documents the literacy campaign. She has fantastic archival footage, but she also interviews many of the women specifically who took part in the literacy program and asks them about their experiences. And this really conveys the idea that it was an emancipatory thing for them. Many of them were young and they had to try and negotiate permission from their parents to go out, leave home for the first time and get involved in this program. And you can really see many of them trace their empowerment and their time within society to that point of the literacy program. And on an international level, it was such a high-profile project. The fact that Fidel announced it at the United Nations and the whole world was aware of what they were doing was a very clear signal on the international stage that they wanted to democratize access to everything.
A lot of resources, as I understand it, were also devoted to training teachers and setting up schools.
Yes, that's right. So in the immediate aftermath of the literacy campaign, you have this newly literate population, many of whom hadn't had access to education before, and some of whom took up places at schools. But many of the people who were taught to read during the literacy campaign were actually beyond school age. So this refers mainly to the people who had served as brigadistas within the literacy campaign. Many of them entered the school system. Some of them were already at university. Budgets for schools were increased tenfold, and schools were built and renovated all around the island to make sure that there was a system in which people could be educated, right from primary through to university-level education. It's important to mention also that when we think about the relationship between education and culture, many of the people who'd served as brigadistas during the literacy campaign were retrained as arts teachers. Tens of thousands of these arts teachers were trained up and took their skills out into the population, initially in factories and farms and other workplaces. And in the heyday of this program, which became known as the Aficionados program, there was around 1 million amateur artists practicing in a population of around 6 or 7 million. And by the same token, art schools were opened up, fantastic international quality art schools in Havana and throughout the rest of the island. The idea was very much that the people would be encouraged to access art in whichever way possible. So there was a huge network of museums and galleries that was built up and renovated, and people were encouraged to visit exhibitions of art that had been requisitioned from the previous regime, new art that was being produced by people within the country. But then Fidel invoked the transition from spectators to creators, and the idea was that art would be made available not just as a passive spectatorship exercise, but as a very active participatory way of producing creative stuff oneself. And so within the capitalist world, we tend to think of there being this great separation between art and the people. That's almost a deliberate and conscious thing that we can trace through history. But in Cuba, that division has largely been broken down, which is quite incredible. It's really one of the biggest experiments in the world that has succeeded in doing that. Within that, there's still a distinction made between amateur and professional artists. So this huge Aficionados program still continues to this day. Everybody has the right to go and access creative activity after work or after school or whatever, learn to make art, learn to play a musical instrument, and if they have an aptitude for it, they can proceed to the professional ranks. So there is, in theory at least, movement possible between the two realms. At the same time, professional level education is fantastic in Cuba. Many, many fantastic professional artists have come out of Cuba. So that's one of the great triumphs of the revolution in terms of culture. The accessibility of film, the accessibility of art, the ability of anybody to get involved in art if that's what they decide to do.
Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt, talking about her book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. And we have links to our guests on our website, againstothegrain.org. That wraps up today's program and the year as far as we are concerned. I'm C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us in 2017. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you could follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Abundant thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.